man with the game information. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Xbox, Nintendo, PC, or PlayStation. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Giving the news to the next generation. Game and Steve. Give me news,
give me news,
give me views,
give me views.
Game and Steve.
Gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one man vortex of gaming information, the man who puts the mega in Mega Man. Ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey there, welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I'm your host, Stephen Glicker, and in this week's show, we go through the latest gaming news, then I have a quick game talk, then in Spore Talk, I go through important dates that everyone should be aware of when it comes to Spore. Then my game review this week is Condemned for the Xbox 360. My retro review is The Bard's Tale for, well, just about every single system on Earth. Then we have the Name That Game contest. Then I have Show Mail, and it's a huge one this week. I have a stack here that's like an inch thick. And then finally, I have Final Thoughts. So, welcome to the first podcast of Gaming Steve in 2006. Hope you guys had a good holiday season. I'm actually recording this on January 3rd, so everyone's back to work and back to gaming and back to everything. We should probably start seeing some news now because it's the new year, the Christmas season's over, and now you're going to start hearing about new releases. I know it sounds crazy, but December and August are usually the deadest months of the year when it comes to gaming news, and December was really quiet, so my stack here of game news is actually pretty short, but don't worry, it's going to be made up quite a bit by the show mail, which is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So let's get into the news, shall we?
Gaming news!
So first up, we have Pokemon USA threatens to sue cancer researchers. So in the January issue of the science journal Nature magazine, Pierre Paolo Poldolf of the Malone Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York, which is right down the street from me, discovered the cancer-causing poke ethanol, mythanol, artunogene, blah, I don't even know how to pronounce it, but they call it Pokemon, and basically if you take the first characters, you have poke, and then E, and then M, and then O-N. And if you take the first characters from each word, it comes out to being Pokemon. So, of course, you've had headlines since then, like Pokemon causes cancer, and things like this. So Pokemon USA, which is a United States corporation which distributes and, you know, makes all the Pokemon products, did not like this and is threatening to sue them. So accordingly, they managed to change the name. It's now ZBTB7. That's the name of the gene itself. So yeah, you got to be careful. I've seen stuff like this before. If you remember, like way long ago in 1993, researchers actually named a gene Sonic after Sega's, Sonic the Hedgehog. It was a hedgehog gene, I believe, so, or something like that. I forgot exactly the exact nature of it, but this has happened before where, you know, they try to be funny, these researchers. But yeah, naming a cancer gene Pokemon, oof, not a very smart move. And what else do we have here? So we have World of Warcraft has hit a population of 5 million people worldwide. So it's like every time I see this, I keep thinking about when EverQuest and all those other games were so proud when they had, like, you know, 400,000 people in the game at one time. And I even remember when The Sims Online was going to come out that they were talking about how, oh, this is going to be the first game ever in the United States to hit 1 million, you know, subscribers, of which, of course, it didn't even come close. And, you know, I keep thinking of all these other games that I've tried, and it's like, and wow, World of Warcraft just keeps getting bigger and bigger. What I do find interesting is this part here where the president and co-founder of Blizzard said, World of Warcraft growth continues to exceed all of our expectations. We want to reiterate our thanks for the millions of players worldwide and all the retailers who have enthusiastically supported the game over the past year. Yeah, I know for a fact that they expect it to easily hit 10 million, that they don't, 5 million, maybe they didn't expect it to go this quickly, but I know that they definitely expect this thing to hit 10 million, no problem whatsoever, especially once you factor in China. In fact, I know that they're expecting to get 10 million subscribers just in China alone. And really not too difficult when you consider the population of China's, 1.3 billion people? So, you put in that, and really 10 million really doesn't seem like that many people if you think about it. But it's, I know everyone else in the industry just is looking at this with, not only are they envious beyond belief, but they just have no idea what to do about it. And the worst part is that people are still playing World of Warcraft, or at least worse in their eyes, and if they're playing the game, they're not playing or buying their games. EA last year basically said that one of the main reasons they didn't do as well is because of World of Warcraft. And I know other publishers are muttering it under their breath too, that they're just, it's like people are playing this game so much that they're just not buying and playing other games. And I know for a fact, at least even in my case, it's true. I mean, I did not play when I was really sucked into World of Warcraft. I had a stack of games that were sitting on my shelf, and I did not buy and play as many games because of it. And I have friends that are still playing to this day, and the only thing they've played, in fact, is Civilization IV, and that's it. I mean, that's all these guys have played since World of Warcraft has come out. They cannot be suckered into anything else. Sucked into anything else. I mean, I'm constantly asking them to try out a new game with me, and they can't. That's all they're doing is playing a World of Warcraft nonstop, and it's really ridiculous because some of these guys have two full sets of purple, which is like the highest you can get, and they have really tier 2 level stuff, which is the highest stuff you can get in the game. And I mean, they really have been playing way too long. If you have two sets of tier 2 purple item, one is for PvP and one is for just a regular rating. Also, on related news, is that the 1.9 patch was released today for World of Warcraft. This is a monstrous patch. This patch is probably the size of most expansions. So, I mean, this is a real big one, so you might want to download that. And another news that you can see that you can actually pre-order the World of Warcraft expansion. It has a list. They're saying it's going to be $40, and it looks like it's coming out around July 1st. I do know for a fact that they are targeting the summer from my friends at Blizzard, and the $40, people are like, oh, it's $40. That can't be right, this expansion. What do you think? Yes, of course it's going to be $40, okay? This is not an expansion. This is another game, okay, in their eyes. This game is huge, and I think you've seen quotes where they've said that this game is, or the quote, the expansion, Burning Crusade, is actually going to be bigger than most games are. And from what I know, it's just going to be an absolute monstrous, just tremendous expansion where they're going to just add a ridiculous amount of content. And, that's the, they're going to try to make as much money as possible. So I bet you if they can charge $50, they would. So, people are like, oh, $40. You know what? Everyone's going to buy it. I mean, if you're into World of Warcraft, you're going to buy it. Everyone I know who actually even stopped playing, the few that did, they're just waiting for the expansion. And then they're going to get right back into it. And, they cancel their account. They're waiting. And then when they get an expansion comes out, wham, they're going to go right into it. Whew. And also, FYI, while I'm on the topic, expect a lot of expansions to come out. Is that, people are saying, oh, when is World of Warcraft 2 coming out? From what I know, never. They're just going to keep doing World of Warcraft forever and just continuously upgrade, the engine dynamically, just continuously upgrade everything on the fly, continuously add new content, add new expansions every few years, and just keep going and going and going. Because if you can see, like, EverQuest 2 sort of killed, in many ways, EverQuest 1, and they don't want that to ever happen, so they're just going to keep going with World of Warcraft forever. And for those who are looking for World of Starcraft, don't hold your breath, because World of Warcraft is making them so much money that, again, there's no reason for them to split their audience out. So, anyhow, let's see. G4 TV, to take on Star Trek. So this actually was a bit of a stunner to me, is that Star Trek The Next Generation is going to begin airing on G4 TV on January 8, 2006, as well as the original Star Trek, which is going to begin the second quarter. So it looks like G4 has officially given up trying to be a video game channel. I mean, first, as soon as they got The Man Show and Fastlane, I knew it was the beginning of the end. And then they actually started to drop their video game shows, and some of their best shows were dropped, which is hard to say because there's really not that many shows on G4 that is good. But, you know, what was going on with G4, and it was actually a very good idea, is that, you know, they were trying to come up with a channel that targets a male demographic. Because if you have the success of magazines like FHM, my wife, by the way, works in the magazine industry, and, I mean, I just follow this pretty closely just through her. And, you know, FHM and all these men's magazines like Maxim, these magazines were insane. I mean, they went from 0 to 100 in no time. They got monstrous amount of subscriptions. They do incredible sales of advertising. They really, really have done well. And, you know, that's a great demographic. It's this male demographic, you know, from about, like, you know, I'd say 18 to, like, you know, 18 to 40-year-old male demographic that has money to spend, you know, single. It's a really, really good demographic. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to figure out, oh, let's make a channel that will just hit that demographic. So we'll hit, you know, we'll do all video games. And Spike TV is the same thing. I mean, they're trying to hit this all-male demographic. And it's a good idea. It just is, Spike TV is actually working, while G4 with just video game content isn't. And the real reason is because, at least in my opinion, is that they can't seem to figure out who they want to be. It's like, you know, as a male who's in his mid-30s who watched G4 a fair amount, you know, some of the shows were really great. You have, like, Filter was sometimes... Actually, Filter wasn't so bad because you actually had the interviews and some of the topics were really great. And then you even had shows, X-Play, which I like a lot. Well, actually, I'll give X-Play as a perfect example. I mean, X-Play, which started out as a fantastic show, as soon as it went to G4, they've been mixing up their reviews with incredibly juvenile humor. So who is this show for? Is this show for me, who's someone in their mid-30s? Or is this for, kids who are 14 years old who are watching this? Okay? I mean, the show is on at 4 o'clock p.m., which is the perfect time for kids coming home from school to watch the show. And it's also on late at night, but they show the reruns after school. So who are they targeting? If you're going to target kids, fine. Then target kids. Make your whole channel towards that. Or at least do your programming during the day for kids and then do your programming at night for adults. Or is it, you know, or are they trying to target just adults like Spike TV is? So... anyhow, rant over. Is I just think, you know, G4 could have had the potential. I was really excited when it came out. For years, I never even had the channel, and then once I got it, I was really excited, and then there was really nothing on it, and now it's dying, and it's taking over Star Trek, which sort of sucks, because I actually like watching The Next Generation on Spike TV. At least Spike still has Deep Space Nine, which is, in my opinion, the best Star Trek series ever. Oh, I love Deep Space Nine. Up next, EA adjusts earning downward. So I think this is the third time they readjusted just this last quarter. They actually had to readjust their third quarter revenue downward from $1.58 billion to... it's actually going to be somewhere between 1.48 and 1.58 billion. So, and that they're blaming the Xbox 360. It's like every year EA blames someone else for their issues. Last year they were blaming World of Warcraft. This year they blame the Xbox 360, as well as right here they say two new platforms. They're also blaming the PS3, which doesn't even exist yet. So, although I'm looking at this, so they're making $1.5 billion in revenue in one quarter. Okay, that's still pretty great. And I remember a couple of years ago when they hit $1 billion for the first time ever in a single quarter. So anyhow, and not only just them, a lot of people. Activision had to revise that they were going down. Take-Two had to revise. EA had to revise, and everyone's advising, and they're saying that, you know, the Xbox 360 is the main culprit. And I have to say, I actually kind of agree with them, is that the Xbox 360 has really sucked the life out of the industry. I know a lot of people who couldn't get their Xbox 360s. They weren't buying anything because they had money saved up. You know, some of them went to eBay, and some of them were just waiting. and they weren't getting anything, or maybe they got Call of Duty for the PC or something, but that's it. And now they're just playing World of Warcraft and to buy the time, and they're just waiting. You know, they're not going to buy anything else. They're not buying something new because they don't want to get into a game and then jump out of it when the Xbox 360 does become available. So, and then also they want to save their money up because it's going to cost like $500-$600 to get the whole system, you know, to get everything and to get the games, to get the extra controller, get the charger, to get everything all together. So they're just waiting. So what happens? No one's buying games. And, you know, so you know what? They're right. This is affecting the industry pretty badly. And I'll be honest, I mean, I'm really stunned how poorly the Xbox 360 launch was performed. And, I mean, but it's probably one of those things we'll look back at 5 or 10 years and find out exactly what happened. But the demand is there, the advertising out there, everything's out there, and except for the units. You just can't buy it. They can't get into the stores fast enough. They did a worldwide launch, which I don't know exactly why they did that. They probably should have just concentrated in the U.S. Maybe they underestimated how popular it would be. Maybe they don't care. Maybe they just said, you know what? There's no such thing as bad press. And, you know, if people have to wait an extra month or two, fine, so be it. They'll still buy the system. As far as I know, everyone I know who's interested in the system is still buying it. They're still getting it. Even though that they didn't get it in time for Christmas, they're still looking and they're still going to go get one. So who knows? But it's I talked about this last week or in my last show, is that, you know, it's starting to get a little scary whether we're in, you know, gonna have another video game crash. Anyhow, let's get back to news. NHL and EA. Now, here we go. This one is a pretty cool story. So, all you guys know that, of course, the NFL cut an exclusive deal with EA, and now football games can only be made by EA for the next 5 years, so no other, you know, football games can be made unless they're like fantasy football or some football that doesn't exist. So it seems that the NHL Players Association signed a 6-year, $44.2 million exclusivity agreement with EA. But they never told the NHL. Now, the NHL Players Association is the association that represents the players. So whenever someone signs a deal with, like, Major League Baseball or any sports organization, you have to sign it with at least two organizations. You have to sign it with the Players Association, and you have to sign it with the league itself. Now, the Players Association gives out all rights to the people's likenesses and their names. A perfect example. So, in other words, if you want to actually use the actual players in the game, you need to, you know, if you want to use, I don't know, like Barry Bonds or Gretzky, whoever in your game, you have to make a deal with the Players Association. If you don't make a deal with the Players Association, you can't use their names. And in fact, for baseball, Barry Bonds decided that he didn't want his name in there, so he took his name out of the Players Association. You actually have to make a separate deal with Barry Bonds if you want to have him in a video game. He didn't put his name, and in all the baseball games, there was no Barry Bonds, believe it or not. There was like number 25 for the Giants, and it was someone else. I mean, it looked like Barry Bonds. He had the same stats as Barry Bonds, but his name was like Barry Ronds or something, and it was something totally different. Just to let you know. And this happens in other past games. I've seen this. What they'll do is that they'll take people that look exactly the same, and they'll put in their stats, but then they won't put in their names. And then I have a friend who actually went into a hockey game and went in and changed everybody's names so that they were actually the correct names. So, that being said, the NHL's Player Association signed an exclusive deal with EA saying that you're the only people who could have our rights. Well, then it gets pretty crazy. The NHL itself said that they went nuts, that they did not approve this deal, and that the Player Association would go behind their back and try to impose exclusivity. And on top of that, they wanted Take-Two in the deal. They liked the 2K series and thought it was actually, in theory, because this is all hearsay, a better series. And the NHL refused to sign anything with EA unless they came up with an agreement that allowed 2K games and Take-Two as part of the deal. So that backfired. Of course, this is all rumor and hearsay, but this is pretty good rumor and hearsay, because this is by the same guys who broke the story that of the NFL Players Association, NFL, making an exclusive deal with EA a couple years ago. So So one more franchise that is not going to be exclusive, it appears, is the NHL, which is really a good thing because the 2K game is really so good for NHL hockey. And the EA game is pretty crappy. So I would have hated to see that. But, I mean, EA, man, they are really playing hardball. They do not want anyone else to compete with them in any way, shape, or form. I mean, oof. Let's see, Judge Block's California game law. So, for those of you who remember, supposedly on January 1st, 2006, there was this law in where the people had to put a big sticker on their games. It was like 2 inches by 2 inches, that if they were inappropriate. Judge White wrote that the games are protected by the First Amendment, worthy of the same protection of expression as books, films, television, and the press. He granted preliminary injunction on the grounds that the terms of the law, which would include a mandate labeling of games deemed unsuitable for minors, would likely be ruled unconstitutional. So it's been blocked. There's still more courts to go through and to actually have this thing totally thrown out of the way. But for now, it's not going to be enforced. And the ESA said that this is the sixth time in 5 years that the federal courts have blocked or struck down these states and local laws seeking to regulate the sale of games to minors based on content. And none have been held up. And this keeps going on. There was actually another, I don't have it in my pile here, but there was another news items that I think was in Illinois decided, even though these game laws were struck down, they actually took like the exact same wording of a game law that was struck down in Michigan, and they're going to make a law anyhow. And then it's going to get struck down again. I tell you, I've said this before, and maybe I'm a pessimist, but it is my firm belief that they're doing this, they being the lawmakers, they do this to appear to be strong so they can say on record that they are against violent video games. And then when the courts knock it down, they can say, well, we did our best. It's those damn pesky courts and the damn judges that are not allowing us to protect your children. But we tried. We passed the law. And it's a real waste of taxpayers' money because this is happening over and over and over again. And luckily, you know, these are all setting precedents that every single time yet another one of these things gets struck down, it becomes easier and easier for another judge in another state to say, wow, why are you guys trying to pass this thing? It's been knocked down in 10 other states. And now you're trying to do the same thing? It's knocked down and, you know, rack up 11th state. You know, things like that. So next up is Jack Thompson buys shares in Take-Two. Now, again, I usually try not to talk about Jack too much, although I've got a couple stories about him now. The main reason he said he wanted to buy shares in Take-Two, and this is why I'm mentioning this, is because he actually wants to attend the shareholder meetings. Now, if you are a shareholder of any company, they have a meeting once a year in which anyone who's a shareholder can attend the meetings. And these meetings are arranged, any of them are there from 1 minute long to several hours long. And then at the meetings, you can actually ask members of the board, you know, questions about how, you know, the company, the direction, things like that. You can talk to them. I actually have been to these meetings. I've actually, Take-Two's meeting is right up the street from me. I've been to it every year. And let me tell you, the Take-Two meeting, it has maybe five people in the room. It takes place in a hotel, usually, in Midtown Manhattan. It starts at 10 a.m., and it's over by 10.05 a.m. I kid you not, it is that short. And one of the best reasons of going to the meetings is usually I get a couple free games out of it, I tell you. So I show up, I talk to some guys, I ask for some games, they give me a whole bunch, and then I leave, and that's the meeting. Now Jack's going to be there. I'm going to bring my recording equipment. I'm going to bring everything. This is going to be great. It's going to be a total circus. Because of course he added, he has this like long rambling statement. But of course he wants a handheld cordless microphone at the meetings. So you can guess what he's going to go and do. He's going to probably rant on these guys like crazy. I've never seen these meetings get out of hand, or I've never seen people get thrown out of them. And these meetings are so, I mean, this is really, it takes place in this room that can hold maybe 20 people. It's like a very small room in a hotel. As I said, maybe five people I've ever seen at these meetings at most. They're very tiny, and it's almost a nothing meeting. But I have a feeling it's going to be a lot crazier this year, and you're going to have security there. It's going to be in a much bigger room, maybe with a platform so that the members of the board can't be accessible as easily. And it's kind of sad, too, because in the past, like, you should just walk up to these guys and talk to them and, you know, mix it up with them. Next up, we actually have The Sims and a whole bunch of other games are getting commemorative postage stamp in France. So let me pull this over. This actually showed up today in the mail. You can actually hear me opening it up. It's in this really cool protective packaging. I actually got a call from the mailman because I live in an apartment building saying that he was coming up and he had registered mail for me. And I was thinking, that can't be good, okay? Because usually if you get registered mail, that means you're either getting sued or you're getting something nasty sent to you. And so I was like, oh, that can't be good. But lo and behold, it was just my stamps that came in. And these are beautiful stamps. It's a package of 10. Let's see, we have Link on one stamp, Mario, Pac-Man, Prince of Persia, Rayman, Lara Croft, Spyro, Donkey Kong, Les Sims, and Abdu. I don't even know. I've never heard of this guy before in my life. I've never even seen him. It must be some French-only video game. As you can see, most of these games actually are Ubisoft or Nintendo, you know, like you have Rayman and Prince of Persia. But this is really beautiful. Not only that, the stamps, you have the 10 stamps, but then all around it you have, like it says, it has video game icons all around it. It has, like, press start. It has score. It has little joypad and buttons. It's really nice. And I got a whole bunch of them. I got a whole pack of these things. So I'm going to give them out as prizes on the show. That's right. So you too can have these beautiful stamps. I actually have a couple in my apartment. I actually have them. I have really pretty stamps. I have like this Snoopy stamps from the Peanuts framed up. I have some baseball stamps. And now I got these. I'm going to make a nice little frame and put up some video game stamps. But I got a whole bunch here. I think I got like 10. So I'm going to give these out as prizes throughout the next couple of months. So, or if you want, you can go to the website and order them yourself. Take a while to get here, I'll tell you that much, because I ordered these things a while ago. And last but not least, okay, this is a news story. This is almost a month old, and it somehow slipped through the cracks, but I have to comment on it, because I know the whole story behind this. Okay, so MarketWatch columnist Herb Greenberg, in early December, named Take-Two's Interactive's Paul Elbert as this year's worst CEO. And this was made a big deal. I mean, I listened to all the other gaming podcasts, and they all mentioned this. And the one thing that surprised me is they're all like, oh, this is such a big deal because it's MarketWatch, it's CBS MarketWatch, and, you know, they're like a big organization, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, I can't believe he's made worst CEO. Well, let me tell you a little bit about that, okay? First of all, the guy who wrote about this, who works for MarketWatch, is a columnist, and his name is Herb Greenberg. Now, Herb Greenberg probably hates Take-Two more than Jack Thompson. In fact, I would say Jack Thompson is on a scale of 1 to 10, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the, like, hates them more than death itself and just wants everyone associated with Take-Two to die. I'd say Jack is maybe a 2. And Herb is like an 11 on that scale, okay? He really hates Take-Two. Because unlike Jack, Take-Two cost Herb billions of dollars, okay? Well, I don't know billions, but hundreds of millions of dollars. And let me go through this. Now, for those of you who might not know this, and this is where this all comes from, is that, now, it might be right, okay? I mean, just to get to that, and then I'll get to the whole history, is that, you know, Take-Two did not have a very good year. I mean, that whole hot coffee debacle, that is bad. But at the same time, I know for a fact that these things do happen with video games, is that I had a piece of software years ago I was developing, and we specifically asked, and these programmers could have gotten sued and held liable for hiding stuff into the code, and we had them sign stuff, and they all said there was nothing in there, and I still found something hidden that was accessible. It was nothing gratuitous. It was just like, you know, it was actually a poem, believe it or not, and this guy put this poem in, and I went through, and I uncoded it out, and I told the guy, I said, you know, you do this again, and we're going to sue you, okay? You don't, we specifically have you sign this draconian document so that you don't do this, okay? And this stuff happens. It's very hard to find this sort of stuff. And on top of that, especially in video games, is that test code and leftover code is left in there all the time, okay? This happens all the time. According to, I just read a report thing on Mario Kart DS, is that there were some hidden levels that were never completed that's still in there that somehow you could access. I mean, they're completely like non-textured and they're all white, but you can sort of see that they're in there. And this stuff happens all the time. So I don't take it that it was his job. And also, he's only been here for a year. So this stuff could have been coded 3 years ago, way before it was his watch. So I don't totally blame him for all these issues. With that being said, Herb Greenberg he's associated with this hedge fund called Rocker Partners. And the Rocker Partners is a hedge fund that goes short on companies, okay? Now, for those of you who don't know how stocks work, is that you can buy stocks in two different ways. You can either buy them long or you can buy them short. If you buy them long, that means is that you buy the stock at, say, 10, and then you sell it at 20, and then you make double the money. If you short a stock, you actually do the opposite. You actually sell it at, say, 40, and then you buy it at 30. And I know it sounds weird, but what you're actually doing is you actually sell the stock, even though you don't own it, and then later you hopefully hope that it goes down and then you buy it back at a lower price. So when you short a stock, the whole point is you buy it high, you sell it high and you buy it low, but you have to do it in reverse order. So what happened in 2001, Rocker and Herb Greenberg said that Take-Two was their biggest short candidate. They're saying this company is totally corrupt. This top company is hiding all this money. Their books are crooked. Like, they had a list of things that were wrong with this company that was a mile long, and that this company was going to be a downfall. They said, basically, put all your money into this company, short it to death. You know, they bought millions and millions of shares, sold millions and millions of shares. They took a tremendous short interest in the company. Something like a third of the shares outstanding at the time were short. I mean, this was a huge amount. And they were targeting Take-Two as guaranteed, you cannot miss, this company is total crap, and it is going to bomb. Well, one thing happened in 2001, and that was Grand Theft Auto 3, which didn't just become the best-selling video game, but became one of the best-selling video games in the history of the world of all kind. Okay, it's the Titanic of video games. You guys all know this. I mean, it was a huge hit, and this happened just as he decided to short the stock. So what happened? The stock, it didn't go down, but it didn't really go up either. And it slowly started to creep up, but it just didn't go down. And they held their short. These guys kept their short, and the stock kept going up and up and up and up. And I don't know exactly, but they had never recovered their money. I mean, they lost millions and millions and millions of dollars. And at the time, in 2001, 2002, they were putting out, day after day, they were putting out one report after another, saying how crappy this company is. They were doing everything, and I mean everything in their power, to make sure that this company wasn't doing well. Okay, what Jack Thompson's doing? Nothing. Okay, it was nothing compared to what Herb Greenberg and Rocker Partners were doing. It was crazy what they were putting out. I never saw so many negative press releases in my life. And you know what? Here's the crazy part. This is what must drive them crazy. They were right. That's the craziest part, is that everything that Herb Greenberg said about this company was correct. They were corrupt. They cooked the books. They had to redo. They were investigated by the SEC. They did all these horrible, horrible things. And if it wasn't for Grand Theft Auto, this company would have been gone. This is way out of business, okay? Take-Two would not exist today. All right, they would have been bankrupt. They would have been sued by the SEC. This stock would have totally tanked. So this is what must drive him crazy, is that they had all the facts right. Everything was correct. All the stars were aligned. Then stupid Grand Theft Auto comes out of nowhere, messes everything up, makes the company billions of dollars, and now they're huge. So this guy, to this day, he doesn't do it quite as much, but every couple of weeks or every couple of months, you see a negative column from Herb Greenberg. But these guys, and it's not just him, but it's everyone who works for him and associated with him. I've never seen anything associated with him that's ever said anything good about Take-Two, ever. And the second something bad happens, they jump all over it. So the company could have 11 months in a row of perfect finances, and then they have one, bad day, bam, there comes the press release saying, oh, this company sucks, this is what's going on, and they'll just go on and on. So this was just yet another axe to grind. It just happened to catch everyone's attention, and it happened to, go along caught on with everyone. It's just amazing that this is going on now for 3-4 years, and they just... This guy is never, ever going to let this go. I mean, he really will never, ever let this go. But again, if you lost a couple $100 million, I think you too would actually have a pretty big axe to grind for quite a while. So anyhow, there is the news. Let's get to the next segment. So Game Talk, normally, as you guys know, in my Game Talk segment, I will sit here and talk about a specific subject for a while. But because my viewer mail is just so absolutely monstrous, I'm going to actually push aside Game Talk for this week, and I'm going to just do show mail later in the show. And otherwise, this will just get too crazy. And actually, one of the topics I was going to talk about is covered in the show mail, so it's all going to go into the same thing. So relax, sit back, go through the rest of the show, and then we'll get to show mail, and you'll hear lots of topics of things discussed. So welcome to Spore Talk, where we talk about Will Wright's upcoming game, Spore. So welcome to 2006. We officially will now start seeing more stuff. I know for a fact we will. And, the game is supposed to come out in fall 2006, less than a year away. And, what that means is that we got a lot of things coming up very soon. Before I get into that, I'm going to release the third picture I got from the dev team. As you guys know, I released two other concept arts that were sent to me, and the third one I said was the best for last, and it really is. It actually shows the recruiting methodology of your creatures in Spore, and it shows both how you recruit in-field and at home, and it's pretty nice. And the nice thing about this, or at least what you can see, is that it looks like every single category section of the game has these levels within the game. So you have to continuously build sub-levels within the city stage and the tribe stage, etc. But what I like about this is that there's even more complexity, because you can recruit in the field and at home. So in the field, I guess that means is that you can actually take your guys and walk them around and try to recruit from other tribes. So once you become sentient... And this is just me speculating from what I know about the game, is that you will not be the only tribe in the game, that there will actually be others, and that you want to go around trying to build up your tribe big enough that you can become more powerful and eventually get into a city. But it goes through the levels and how it really builds up over time. And as for what I'm going to talk about, I have a lot of questions. You guys sent me a whole bunch after I went through a whole bunch last week, but I'm not going to get into the questions just now. I do want to get into some dates. Some people keep asking me. I'm getting a lot of emails on this, so I thought I'd just kill... Actually, let me kill all the birds with one stone. A lot of people ask me, when's the game coming out? I can't believe how many emails I get on this one. It's supposed to come out fall 2006. What platforms is it supposed to come out on? PC, definitely. Probably Mac, just because Maxis comes out with everything on the Mac. Other systems... it's been rumored for the Xbox 360, and after playing the Xbox 360 and seeing the live capabilities, I have zero reason to figure why this couldn't come out and for the 360 very easily. And you can play Spore in theory on the 360 with or without live capabilities. The same way you can play it on the PC with or without being hooked up to the internet. If you're hooked up to the internet, the game will just be that much better, because you can download everyone else's creatures, worlds, everything. But if you're not, there's more than enough content on the disc. The disc is going to have so much stuff that you can play the game and never see the same stuff twice. It's just going to be a ridiculous amount of content. And the reason they can do it is because everything, any single item in the game is less than 1K in size. So 1K, that's very small. And I know they're going to just put so much stuff on the disc that it's going to be crazy, enough to fill up a literal virtual universe. And then from there, who knows? But let me put it this way. Look at what they do with SimCity. Look at what they do with The Sims. I mean, The Sims has come out with every single platform known to mankind. So what do you think they're going to do? They're going to probably try, and they being EA, is going to try to make Spore as big a deal as possible. But for a fact, it will come out for the PC. I know that for a fact. After that, who knows? It'll probably come out for other platforms, you know, like PlayStation 3 and any Nintendo and blah, blah, blah. Probably in time. The same way, you know, The Sims took a while before it came out, and it could maybe even be a different game, the way The Sims is a slightly different game on platforms because they, you know, make it a little more goal-oriented. It's not exactly the same game. And also, they do it to make money. That's why if you love The Sims and the game is slightly different on your console, then you go buy the console version so you can play The Sims and get a new experience. So maybe they'll do something similar with Spore. But dates to keep in mind, we have the DICE Summit. That's February 8th to February 10th. Now, why are these dates important? That's what Will Wright is speaking there. So he probably will talk about Spore. I mean, who knows what he's going to talk about. But usually they go to these events. Usually they're going to talk about their current projects. That's one of the main reasons you go to these events. And I will be amazed if he doesn't talk about Spore. Next up, we have the Game Developers Conference, which is from March 20th to March 24th. We have two talks going on. Actually, Will Wright was supposed to talk, but it was canceled. But there's two developers of the Spore team that are going to be there doing talks. I actually know them, so I'm definitely going to be there. So they're talking about Spore, so we're going to have at least two talks that I'm going to definitely cover because I'm going. I always go to GDC. Got a lot of people asking me, are you going, Steve? I already got my tickets. Already going. And then finally, E3, which is May 9th to May 12th. That will probably be the big unveiling of Spore. We'll probably see it all over the booth. It'll probably be all over the place. I can't think of any other huge games EA is going to have coming up this year besides their standard stuff. This will probably be, you know, the monster game, the way that The Sims 2 was their monster game 2 years ago. So I have a feeling we're going to see more stuff on Spore than we ever wanted to know about, period. And I put out a call last week. If you guys want to help out with my website, I'm doing a Spore website, a shoot off from the Gaming Steve website. If you guys want to help out, let me know. You're definitely going to have access to stuff that no one else is going to have access to, early access to content, things like that. Let me know, you know, programmers, things like that, anyone experienced with web development and wants to volunteer, write me an email. You can write me contact@gamingsteve.com. But those are the three areas that you really should be paying attention to dates, early February, end of March, early May, the DICE Summit, the GDC, and E3. DICE Summit, I don't know if I'm going to go to. It's super expensive. It's like $2,000-$3,000, and it's very small. When I mean small, I mean like 10 presenters. It's an incredibly tiny event. GDC, I go to every year. It's fantastic. E3, go to every year. So I'm definitely going. So those are the big events. Make sure to mark your calendars now, and we'll find out a lot more then. Otherwise, I'll address questions and things I'll be getting in the next coming weeks. And that is my Spore talk for now.
Game reviews! Game reviews! Game reviews!
So my review for this week is Condemned Criminal Origins for the Xbox 360. This is made by Monolith. It's the same guys who did Fear earlier this year for the PC. And I have to say that of all the Xbox 360 games, I think that this is the best of all of them right now. It was the strongest and best launch title. And the reason I'm saying that is because, yeah, there was things like Call of Duty 2, which is also a superb title. But Call of Duty 2, I'm kind of disqualifying it a little because you can't get it on the PC and it's the exact same game on the PC. So, you know, it's not really an Xbox 360 only game. You know, like Halo was the launch title for the Xbox. And for me, this is the launch title for the Xbox 360. You can only play it on the 360. There's no other way to play this game. It's not on anything else, and that's why I'm saying it's the premier launch title. On top of that, of all the launch titles I played that, you know, only for the 360, you know, like Perfect Dark and Cameo and all these others, this is my favorite one by far. And I'd say this is one of the strongest games I've seen for the launch of a system, period. It's so well made and it's so advanced in so many ways. I'm kind of surprised that this thing was actually made on the 360. Usually 360 games are a little wonky and aren't, you know, completely not 360, but any game made for, any game made for a launch is usually not quite finished and there usually has issues with it. But this game, this thing could have been released in a year from now and it still would have been a fantastic game. But let's get into it. It's a first-person, I'd say, melee game. It's not a shooter. It's a first-person melee game. There's some shooting aspects, but they're almost non-existent. It's a horror game, or survival horror, if you will. It's a little short. It takes 10 hours around to finish. There's 10 missions in total. But I tell you, I know a lot of people who are replaying this game over and over again. I played many of the levels several times. I didn't go through the whole game a second time, but I redid a lot of the levels just to see how things would occur and to try stuff out in the game. You are an investigator who's basically investigating a series of murders. The game is pretty grisly. I mean, just to start off, let me tell you one thing. It's that the game is really, really nasty. As soon as you start playing it, you can tell right away you're going to be in for kind of a hard time. And just even the very first crime scene, it's pretty shocking just even to see that, is where you're seeing a guy who's murdered, and there's, a woman that's murdered, and there's mannequins all over the place. And just seeing these mannequins in this dark room, this creepy shadows, just seeing that will freak you out. And that sort of is the tip of the iceberg. The game gets a lot worse, or aka better, after that. Of all the games I've ever played that are supposed to be these horror games, this is the only game I can think of that really was scaring the crap out of me. And, I mean, I was demoing this game to friends of mine in broad daylight, and we were, I mean, they were jumping out of their seats. And one of the main reasons it's so successful is, well, there's a lot, but one of the main reasons is the combat system. The combat system really works because it is hand-to-hand combat. And because of that, it's really terrifying. I mean, you are going around picking up objects. You have a gun, you lose the gun. I'm not giving anything away. You lose the gun within the first 2 minutes of the game. And throughout the game, there are weapons, but there's no ammo. And you know what? I like that, because that's like real life. Okay, you find a gun, it's got 6 bullets in it, that's all you got. And when those 6 bullets are gone, you're out of luck. You got to go find something else. So how the game works is that you just have to find anything you can, and you use that as a weapon. If you see a pipe on the wall, you pull the pipe off of the wall. If you see an electric conduit, you take that. You see a sign, you pick up the sign. You see the door to a metal locker, pick that up. Whatever you can find, you can use as a weapon. There's countless number of weapons in the game. Personally, my favorite weapon, give you an idea how grisly this game is the paper cutter. You know those blades and those paper cutters where you can take the blade off and use that as a weapon. Yeah, it's pretty nasty, but really powerful. Fire axes, sledgehammers, or you name it. It's pretty grisly. The range of weapons is fantastic, and the other cool thing is the weapons degrade. So eventually the weapons will break, and even your guns could be used as weapons. When you run out of ammo, you flip the gun over, and then you're hitting people with the barrel of the gun. And very shortly, the barrel will break because the guns are pretty weak when you're using them as melee weapons, and then they're gone. You have to find something else. The melee aspect's really good. You can go in. There's really only 2 things you can do. You can swing and you can block. And you really have to get the timing down right. All the weapons have different capabilities. Some have a longer reach. Some have shorter reach. Some, basically, actually, there are 4 categories: damage, speed, block, and reach. And that's it. Some, like, you know, if you have a sign, their reach and their block is fantastic, but their speed, and speed might be very slow, and their damage moderate, because you're getting hit with a sign, which is bad, but not as bad as getting hit with a fire axe, which is really slow, but super deadly. And then throughout the combat, you can also do these things called finishing moves, is where once you weaken them, you can then go up to them and do things like, snap someone's neck or ram them with your forehead or knock them out or slam their head into the ground. Again, it's a real family-oriented game. This game is not family-oriented. That's pretty much the whole game. I mean, you know, it's one of those games that has a lot of atmosphere to it. But, you know, most first-person shooters have this. You go around... in solving crimes. There are, it's sort of a weird mix. There's a CSI aspect, is where you're going around and the story will develop, and to flesh out the story, you go around and there's certain times in the games where you'll be asked, you'll get cell phones, or you'll get, or you want to collect evidence. It'll automatically do this for you, is that you'll always pull out the tool that you need, but then you go around and you have to hunt for maybe fingerprints or something, or DNA samples, or take some pictures and send them back to the lab for analysis, things like that. But I think it really works well because they integrate this into the game. For instance, there's levels and where you're following blood trails is actually pretty common in the game, and you have to see where the killer went. So you're using infrared to see where the blood is, and then you actually have to follow the blood. So one thing that makes this game so scary is not only were the graphics crazy, the combat's crazy because you have to go, you know, right up to these guys. They can hit you. And by the way, one of the best things about the combat is when you get hit, your vision gets all blurry, your head gets snapped around, you are disoriented. And worse, if they actually grab hold of you, forget it. Everything goes blurry, it's very hard to see. You will run backwards to actually hide for a few seconds to catch your breath and gather your wits. And that's something else I love about this game, is that it really has fantastic hand-to-hand combat, and I can't, it's so hard to do hand-to-hand combat, and this game just does it flawlessly. The thing is that the game is very dark, and because of that, you have a flashlight, and you're always using the flashlight. The lightings the light looks incredible in the game. The flashlight, again, that's what makes this game, one of the things that makes it so scary, is you can't see everything. And very often, you'll be running around, and the sound is so superb in this game, that you'll hear someone coming to you, running at you, to your left side. And you'll quickly look to the left, trying to find this maniac who's about to hit you in the head with a sledgehammer. And you can only see, you know, blurs and shadows, and trying to find out exactly where they are. But I tell you, when you know you have to follow a blood trail, and you have to look down the whole time, and all you have is this little cone of light, you know, great, something's going to jump out and kill me. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. And that's something else about this game, is that they don't use the same tricks twice. You know, when you have games like Fear, or Doom 3 is a perfect example. You know, when I first started to play Doom 3, I was so scared. It was a really scary game. But after a while, I saw the pattern. Like, okay, yeah, there's a locker. All right, he's going to jump out as soon as I pass him. And I'll turn. By halfway through the game, I would see a locker. I would walk past it. I would turn around, shoot, kill it, whatever was coming out. I wouldn't even see it because I knew it was coming out, and then keep going because I just knew the pattern. And this game, you rarely will see the same thing happen twice. I mean, okay, maybe something will jump out of a locker and scare you. It will happen exactly once in the game, at least in that methodology, and never again. So for the rest of the game, you're on edge. Or better yet, you didn't expect that because you've gone through 25 lockers and nothing's jumped out at you, and then the 26th, something jumps out and scares the crap out of you. And then for the rest of the game, you're on edge, but then it never happens again. And then something else scares the crap out of you. One thing else is that the lighting is so good that you will jump at your own shadow. I must have done it 50 times, is that you'll see, like, oh my god, what is that? Okay, oh, it's just my shadow. The actual level design, it's weird. I've been reading a lot of reviews. A lot of people thought the level design was not so great. I'll be honest, I don't know what the heck these people were thinking. The actual level design is a little linear, and there are artificial barriers, so you really have to go. It's very straight. But you know what? All games are like this, okay? All first-person shooters, Halo 2, I mean, yeah, you have to backtrack, but they're put on rails, all right? A lot of these first-person, not all, like, you know, Far Cry wasn't quite like that, but most first-person shooters, even Half-Life, one of my favorite games of all time, is essentially on rails. I mean, you have to go in a certain order. You have to go from one place to another. Maybe you can get there in different ways. Maybe, you know, there's like two routes to get there, but you do have to hit these certain checkpoints. The one thing, this game is you really have to go, there's only really one way ever to get any places. There's like two levels, three levels, and where there's a little bit of, you know, you can sort of go in different ways. You can do the level in different orders. But other than that, this game, you know, is on rails, but I liked it. And it's also a convention of the game. To really do a horror game well, they actually have to, you know, it's hard to do a horror game without putting things in a certain order. Otherwise, you know, the timing might be off, things might not happen in the correct sequence. You know, things like that. The actual levels, as I said, I thought they were fantastic. The detail in these levels was incredible. I mean, there's part that takes place in the subways and all that. I mean, I go to subways every day. The authenticity and detail was incredible. just little things like, you know, there's this one that takes place in a school, and they have, like, things that are like the bleachers on the wall. You know how those bleachers come out in high schools? They're done perfectly. Okay, they have nothing to do with the gameplay. You never use them. They're just an element. They didn't need to do that. They didn't need to make all the different types of rooms in the school, but they did. You know, they'll have the different classrooms, they'll have the locker rooms, the food court, the cafeteria, the hallways, the principal, you know, all these offices. Like, all this stuff was done, and it's done beautifully. They didn't have to do that, but they did. They really had care and attention. And this is when you know how beautiful the textures are, is that there's a part in the game is where there's a famous painting, The Fall of Babylon. I actually stopped to look at this painting, which I actually have seen in real life, and view it and take it in inside a video game. Okay, I don't think I've ever done that before in my life. I'm actually sitting there to look at a real piece of art in a video game. That's how beautiful the textures are. Levels themselves, they're varied. Probably the scariest thing I've ever played in my life is in this game. There's one level that I can't even give anything away, but let's just say there's a lot of things that appear. You'll be playing this game a lot, is where there'll be, I don't know, I'm going to say mannequins throughout a store, and you'll be seeing, like, you know, oh, there's like five mannequins in front of you, and then something attacks you to the left, and you take it out, and you look back, and now there's six mannequins. Wait a second, weren't there just five mannequins there? Am I going crazy? And sure enough, then they'll come alive and kill you. So, things like that. I mean, you're always on edge. You're not exactly sure what's going on. They do things like that. The actual cutscenes of the game, for the negatives, I'll say, the cutscenes are pretty not so great, unfortunately. It's the only part of the game that disappoints in terms of graphics. Otherwise, the levels and the detailed graphics are just stunning, and it really shows the power of the 360. The enemy AI, anything by My Monolith, always has fantastic enemy AI. This is no exception. I mean, I would sit there just watching the enemies. You know, they try to attack you, or they use a shotgun, and then, you know, they'd use up the shotgun, they would drop into the ground. You'd see them actually look around, find a weapon, like they'd see, you know, a sign on the wall. They'd go rip the sign off from the wall and then come at you with the sign. And then you kick the sign out of their hand, and then they look around and see a pipe on the floor. And they'd go backwards, go back, grab it, and come back after you. So it really was beautiful just to watch these guys interact. The other thing is, they'll fight each other. I love games where you can do that. You can have three massive guys that are coming up to attack you. Kick one to the other one, have them start hitting each other, and sit back and watch them beat the crap out of each other, and then eventually they'll pay attention to you. And just finally, the last level in this game is some of the most amazing use of light and weaponry I've ever seen before. And actually, and super finally, the other thing about this game that I really like is that the monsters, they're different. Every level or two, you have different types of creatures attacking you. They are all kind of the same in some respects, but they all have different personalities. Some are big brutes, some are super spry that can jump around and do tricks. Some are just like screaming and just coming right at you. Some are real aggressive. They'll duck and, you know, they'll come right at you, but they'll duck and they'll use cover, things like that. But every level or two, you will see new monsters. All the way up to the final level, there's always new creatures to appear. One thing is the story. Unfortunately, I would say the story is actually really good, but it's not in the game. The only way you can find the story is if you unlock everything and you get all these like pamphlets that have like a backstory and you can read them. So the bad news is the very good story, which leaves room for a really cool sequel, is not in the game. You actually have to find this stuff. The good news is that you can easily go to the internet, because I didn't unlock, I mean, this is a lot of stuff to unlock, is I didn't unlock everything. I went to the internet, I read all the pamphlets and achievements, and sure enough, once I really found out the backstory, I was like, oh, this is a very, very good game, very good backstory, and it actually opened up really good possibilities for another future game. Anyhow, you really should get this game. I do say this game is super scary. Even if you play it in the middle of the day, it's pretty scary, but play it the way I played it. I played it at night, at midnight, pretty much every day for a week. with the lights off and headphones on, and oh yeah, you will be scared, I promise you, if you immerse yourself in this game. And you know what, even if you don't immerse yourself, as I said, you just play this in the middle of the day, I was still jumping out of the seat. Probably not as scary, but definitely a definitely surprising game. Definitely get this game. I'd say 9.5 out of 10. You know, it's only single player. It is a little short, but it is a great 10 hours. It is really memorable, lots of fun. It'll keep you going. You'll want to keep playing it. And the difficulty level is just right, which is something I really like seeing in games. And unique weapons galore. So get it.
Gaming Steve's Retro Review.
So the retro review this week is The Bard's Tale. I'm actually going to talk specifically about Tales of the Unknown, Volume 1, The Bard's Tale, from 1985. So, The Bard's Tale actually is, there's three games in total. There was The Bard's Tale 2, The Destiny Knight, The Bard's Tale 3, Thief of Fate. And Bard's Tale 2 came in 86, Bard's Tale 3 came in 88, and then The Bard's Tale was actually redone in 2004, which was a completely different game. It had nothing to do with the originals. This was probably one of my absolute favorite games as a kid. If you ever played Wizardry or any of the really old classic fantasy role-playing games from the Atari days, this is in the same vein, in the sense that how it would work is that you will have a party of six characters, and the whole screen consisted of this. Picture in the upper left-hand corner, you had a little picture that would show you what your party would view, and this was like pseudo 3D, which by the way was unique at the time. Wizardry did this, but this was full color 3D, gorgeous, gorgeous graphics for the time. And this was the equivalent of like a 360 back then. You know, you'd be like, oh my god, I cannot believe these graphics. It was just stunning. I could sit there for hours and hours just staring at these beautiful graphics. In the upper right-hand corner of the screen, you have, you know, it has all the text telling you what you're doing, the menus, things like that. And then the bottom half of the screen, the whole bottom half, lists your six characters and all their stats. And that's it. The entire game is done on this one screen. There's nothing else in the game. Everything, loading the game, saving the game, everything. Only in this one screen, only in this one interface. And that's how all these games were back then. And you know what? That's all you really needed. It actually worked very well. The game was, as I said, it was published by EA. And I remember this was, EA was a really cool company. EA was back then kind of like, oh, I can't even think of what is like a cool company today. There really is no cool companies. And like Rockstar of today. I mean, EA was a cool company. They were coming out with great games. They're real up and coming. They were coming out, you know, they had like Archon, and they had, Dr. J and Larry Bird. They had, you know, they had all these fantastic games. They had Bard's Tale. Like, I was really always excited whenever EA was coming out with a new game. And this is one of the first games they ever came out with. It came out for, are you ready for this? It came out for the IBM PC, the Apple II, the Apple II GS, the Commodore 64, the Atari ST, the Amstrad CPC, the Amiga, the NES, the Macintosh, and the Sinclair ZX. Wow, that's a lot of systems. Okay, so this game really, really traveled quite a bit. I bought it for the Apple II Plus back in the day. It was actually made by Michael Cranford from Interplay Productions. So Interplay actually made the game, and this one guy, for as far as I know, pretty much made most of the game, and he actually, and then was published by EA, and then, as I said, Bard's Tale 2 came out, and Bard's Tale 3, and those came out for the Amiga, Apple II, Commodore 64, and the IBM PC. There also was another weird one. In 1991, there was the Bard's Tale Construction Set, which was released by Interplay for the Amiga, remember that, and the IBM PC, and allowed you to actually make games in the same style as Wizardry and the Bard's Tale series. So I never got that game because I was kind of in college then, so I always would have loved to have seen that. But the game itself, for those of you who don't know how these games used to play, they really were all about character development and character creation. And one thing about this game, I mean, there's a story, of course. You know, you're in this town. The entire game takes place in this town where this evil wizard, Mangar the Dark, has isolated town from all help by casting a spell of eternal winter in the surrounding countryside. So, okay, you're stuck in a town. Why? There's eternal winter everywhere else, so you can't leave the town. Oh, okay. There you go. That's how you solve that problem. One of the things about this game which really made it great was the magic system. This was such a good system. I really enjoyed it. You kind of see some games do this type of systems, but not quite like the way they did it. There was actually four different types of people you can be. You can be a magician, a conjurer, a sorcerer, or a wizard. The magician basically did spells on non-magical items. The conjurer, of course, would conjure creatures, which was really great. And sorcerer would deal with illusion. And then the wizard would summon monstrous creatures, like these crazy huge creatures. What made the level so cool is that there were seven levels of spells per class. And what would happen is if you were a conjurer, after you got past the third level, you can change your class. So you can go from conjurer, then changes to a magician, and then eventually change to something else. So you could start off as one class and continuously change your classes, getting more and more and more spells. So what you'd often do is you'd start off, say, as a magician, and then once you got up to level 7, you'd change over to a conjurer. Then once you got up to level 7 there, you'd become a sorcerer, and then eventually you'd become a wizard. And the only way you can become a sorcerer was you had to master one of the other two schools of magic. And then, to become a wizard, you had to master two schools of magic. So you couldn't start off as a wizard or sorcerer. You had to be a magician or conjurer. Then you become a sorcerer, and then you become a wizard. Or you become a magician conjurer, and then you become a wizard. But the wizard was really, really slow to advance. So you always became the wizard last, because you never would become a wizard and then become a sorcerer. It was really kind of silly. And you could never go back. So once you changed your class, that was it. But what was great is then by the end of the game, you had all these great spells and a diversified spells. And I think that would be great. And modern systems, if you could do that, if you could start off as a magic user in an RPG and then eventually change it over to become a cleric and then maybe a summoner and an illusionist or who knows. And even if games like World of Warcraft, things like that, that would be great if you can do that. The fighting classes, they were standard. There was monks, paladins, hunters, warriors, rogues. And then, of course, you had your bard, which had to be in the party, and they can cast six musical spells. The fighter class is my favorite, was the monk, because by the end of the game, the monk was wearing, as they got more and more powerful, end of the game, you're wearing robes, and your armor class was, they actually had an armor class of LO, meaning low, meaning it was so low there was no number for it. That was something else memorable of this game, is your armor class. It was right out of D&D, it had like armor class of 10 was the worst, and went down to like -9, but then 10, LO was like below -10. They didn't even show it because it was so low. You had your standard things. You wanted to have your magic users with a high IQ, your fighters you wanted to have high strength, and so on. There was like some statistics associated with it. But what made this game memorable is not only were the really beautiful 3D graphics, and this game actually kind of looks almost like the game before Quake or Doom, sorry. And I know for a fact that the guys who wrote Doom, Carmack and those guys, actually liked and used sort of 3D graphics in the Bard's Tale as inspiration for them to make Wolfenstein 3D and Doom. And it was just done in a much smaller scale. But you would actually walk through the hallways, and when you would walk through these things, they would actually advance. So it felt like you were really going through the towns from a first-person point of view. The other thing about this game that really made it memorable were the levels. Now, back in the day, and they would never do this type. I mean, this is one of these games you would just never see. You'll never see this type of game ever again. Because what would happen is that there was a whole bunch of dungeons. You had to go through the wine cellars, the sewers, the catacombs, a castle, a tower, and then Mangor's Tower. And that's how the game would go through. So the game was just consistently the same, is that you would go through a dungeon, you get your characters more powerful, you get certain items, you would go back to town, gear up, go back in the dungeon over and over and over again, get your characters more and more powerful, fight huge amounts of monsters, and build up your characters and eventually get to the end of the game. And that was the whole game. But the levels were beautiful, and you had to map them out. And this is why I say you'll never have this type of game. It's funny. I look online, and there was some people had their maps of these graph paper. I had the same thing. You had to take out graph paper. You had to map very carefully where you were going, all the rooms. You had to make sure you knew everything, because you only saw a very small corridor, and these corridors were, these maps were very big, and these were very complex dungeons. There was doors everywhere, and the worst is you'd be teleported, sometimes randomly, in these dungeons. So imagine you're mapping this thing out really, really carefully, and then poof, you're teleported, and you're like, okay, great. And some of these maps, you'd be like, okay, I'll just go find the wall and try to figure out where I am. Well, then it got crazy when you'd have the maps that wrapped around. Ugh. I still remember that going off my graph paper and saying, wait a second, what the heck's going on? And then I look and see that I actually kept going and I had to keep, and I was like, oh, okay, I see things starting to wrap. But, this is, I mean, you spent most of your time building up your characters, fighting really cool monsters, looking at these pretty pictures, and mapping. You know, you'd sit there, I must have spent days just sitting there carefully mapping out these, you know, these dungeons. And later on, I mean, these dungeons really, again, you'll never see this type of stuff nowadays. There was one dungeon where every single room was nothing but four doors, okay? Now, there was actually was a dungeon, so sometimes these doors wouldn't go anywhere. So imagine a maze, but every maze is a 10-foot by 10-foot room with doors. Let's just give you an idea how crazy this was. So you had to map it out. You always had to know exactly where you were. And because if you went through that, you know, you go through that maze, and I don't remember if that one wrapped or not, but if that thing wrapped, you know, so the, you know, just kept going around and around over and over again, there were no edges, you go insane trying to find the exit to these things. So there was the actual levels themselves were really beautiful. I remember the catacombs specifically was really pretty shocking, because you'd be like in the catacombs and like you'd be in the first level and it looked like just a dungeon. The second level you'd be in the dungeon, but then like the third level you'd actually see skulls in the walls and it looks like so you know catacombs from like France, and it was just so shocking. It's like, oh my god, ooh, it's like I'm really far down deep and you have all these crazy creatures. I love this game. I spend way too much time on it. I have tons of great memories of this game. The one problem with the game, believe it or not, it sort of was cool, but it's kind of a bad thing. You can actually import your characters from other games into this game. Imagine you could do that nowadays, if you could actually like import your characters from Final Fantasy into, oh, I can't even think of it. Imagine you could take your characters from Final Fantasy VII and import them into Final Fantasy, 10 or whatever, you know, 10X or 7X, whatever I'm thinking of, you know, guys know what I'm talking about. But you can take Wizardry and you can port your Wizardry characters into Bard's Tale. And actually, that's sort of one of the things that sort of put the game off for me, is because when I bought Bard's Tale 2, I was so excited to play it. And then when I imported my Bard's Tale 1 characters, they were so ridiculously powerful that, you know, it obviously wasn't a challenge. But the other problem was is that I got everything. I got every spell. I got all the best stuff. And it took out the magic of the game. You know, one of the big things about these games is, like, you couldn't wait to, you know, become the wizard and try out those really cool conjure spells and see these monsters, these huge monsters you could conjure up. And, you know, you'd sit there for hours and hours playing so you could see that spell. But, you know, when I got Bard's Tale 2, I got to see every high-level spell within the first hour of playing the game, and I never got into it, and then I never really played them since. But these really were great games, sort of, you know, for the time. These type of games you'll never see again, unfortunately. They're just, they've advanced too much. Things like these maps that you spend hours on, you know, you just go to the internet and download them, you know. You would never sit there doing this nowadays. There's no need to. Hint books, things like that. I mean, all this stuff, it totally takes that fun out. But for those out there who remembered it, this was a fantastic, wonderful series. I actually had never played. I actually owned the new Bard's Tale. I just never got into it. I was real busy at time when it came out, but I have it on my list of things to play, and I'm about to finish up some games, and I'm going to definitely try that one out next. So there we go. There's my retro review for this week. Let's get to the next feature.
Name that game!
So next up we have Name That Game. It's my weekly contest where I will play a video game sound, and you guys have to write in, and if you get it right, I will draw everyone who gets it right, throw into a bin, draw out their name, and you get a random free prize. I have so many prizes now, I don't even know. I've actually been buying and finding stuff at, like, there's a lot of weird stores in Manhattan, and just some of the swag I have. Like, I have t-shirts, and I just have this weird stuff from Japan that you just really can't find anywhere else. But luckily, these wacky, crazy stores are a dime a dozen in New York City, so it's not so hard for me to find this stuff. All video game related, of course. And I kind of went overboard. I think I have enough stuff to last, like, the next 2 years. But anyhow, let's listen to last week's game.
Thank you.
So that was, of course, Frogger for the arcades. I actually thought that that sound sounded a lot like Tapper, and I thought a lot of people were going to write to me and thinking that it was Tapper, but no one did, so pretty good. So let's see, who do we have? Who's going to be the random person? Here we go. Hey, Gaming Steve, this week's pass name that game is Frogger for the Arcades. It was made back when the game designer also had to make, also had to be the game composer. It was made back when the game designer also had to be the music composer. Because of that and lack of memory, most games those days had a simple music schema. Of course, you already knew that. I just wanted to sound like I knew something too. Haha. Thanks for entertaining me every week. Such a great podcast, Chris from Cincinnati. So, Chris from Cincinnati, yes, you've won. Contact me, write me, give me your address, and I will send out a prize. I have so many cool things. Maybe I'll send you some of these cool French video game stamps. These things really are cool. Maybe I'll send you out those to you. But this week, let's play this week's entry. And once again, just send me an email, contact@gamingsteve.com or game@gamingsteve.com. Anything will get to me. And I will throw you in if you get it right. And maybe you'll win. Just listen to the next show. So let's listen to this week's. Come on, that one was so simple. Come on, everyone knows this one, right? Everyone. Oh, so easy. Let's one more time. All right, so there we go. Good luck to everyone, and find out if you win next week. Let's get to the next segment.
Showmail!
Okay, so welcome to Showmail. This is where you guys can just write me questions, and I will answer them. If you send me an audio question, I will always, always, always answer those on the air, as long as they're not vulgar or anything like that. Just record yourself in a, you know, as an MP3 or WAV file, whatever, and send that on over, and as long as it's so, sort of clean. I actually have a voicemail. I just have to set it up so you guys can call it. But other than that, you know, send me questions. I almost always, 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 always will answer your questions, even by email. If I don't get to you, just write me a reminder, because I'm usually pretty good, and I go through my email every week, but sometimes it gets crazy, and I might get 50 emails in a day, so I do my best. And, oh yeah, and those guys who, everyone who signed up for Xbox Live who put me as their friend, I haven't been on the Xbox 360 in like a week, and I just haven't accepted anyone, but I think I have like 60, 70 people like waiting to be accepted, I think I'm about to hit the limit there. What's it, like 200? So, Don't give up hope. I'll be back. Don't worry. I'm finishing up a couple of games on the Xbox that don't work on the Xbox 360, of course. So I just haven't been turning that thing on. But with that being said, ooh, let's get to this huge stack. Oh, boy. Try to get through these very quickly. Hey, Steve. I love the show. Something's been troubling me lately. What's in store for online gaming? I hate online gaming with a passion. I really, really, really hate it. Online gaming is worse than having your eyes gouged out by an enraged gorilla with gonorrhea. No matter what game into it, whatever what game you get into, three things are invariably true. One, everyone plays the game obsessively and therefore is better than you. Two, everyone is a moron. Three, the single-player mode is more fun anyways. Enough ranting. My real question, will the PS3 be as online-oriented as the Xbox 360? Will this be a good thing or a bad thing for Sony? I don't ever want to see another online Final Fantasy, and I hate to see the PS3 become an online hub for boring multiplayer crap. Max Lawlor. Lawlor? Lawlor. So, Max, wow, that was pretty forceful. And there's actually other things in there, that a lot of cursing and stuff that I took out just to clean it up. He really, trust me, he doesn't like online playing. Yeah, to be honest with you, I actually don't love online playing myself either. and you're right. A lot of people who do play online, you know, it's hard to play because you'll be playing and there's people that are going to be much better than you. You know, it's very hard to handicap online playing. You know, if you're playing someone who in Halo who's just a little bit better than you, you're probably going to lose, and probably pretty often. Same thing, if you're just a little bit better than them, it's not like there's, you know, there's a huge way to balance these things out. What I'd really like to see is not, you know, right now they're putting together different systems for matching people, like a matchmaking system, which I think is the first step. But better than a matchmaking system is a handicap system. You know, for instance, if you're playing Halo, and if you really, and if you have, I don't know, we're just going to say 1,700 points, and someone else, I know that's not the system you're using, but I've been playing some like online chess and stuff, and I'm just thinking of the chess system. And if you're ranked like 1,700 and someone else is ranked 1,400, then the person who's 1,700 should have a lot less, you know, take a lot less damage before they die. And the person who's 1,400 should be able to hit the, you know, be able to take a lot more damage before they die. You know, same way, I'm thinking like golf has a way to handicap. And that's the beautiful thing about golf is that anyone can play golf at any level. You know, you can be amazing and I can be terrible, but at the end we adjust our scores so that we each can play each other. And that's one of the main reasons that people enjoy golf so much is that you can play with someone who's a pro and still have a very similar experience as they do. But yeah, I agree that online playing is you either love it or you absolutely hate it. But it is the future, and there are a lot of aspects that are fun about online playing. You know, when I do play with my friends, there's nothing like it. I mean, I just love playing online with my friends, especially doing like co-op missions. It's just great. I love doing that sort of stuff. But for the PS3, I have a feeling they're not going to be making online as big a deal. They'll make it a big deal, but it's just not a big a deal because Japan is such a huge market for them. And right now, online gaming is not that big in Japan. Console-based online gaming is just not that big a deal in Japan. It just isn't. You know, there's, and the reason is because there's other ways to do it. You know, right now, if you want to do online gaming in the U.S., you could do it on the PC. And now you can do it on the console, and that's kind of it. But in Japan, you can do online gaming through your cell phone. You can do it through IM. There's a lot more methods to actually get around on. And basically, actually, your cell phone is that's the main way. There's so many online, you know, games in Japan, and people use their cell phones like crazy. I mean, just nuts in Japan and basically Europe and Asia and other markets. I mean, compared to the U.S. is like way behind. So, I mean, so far behind that cell phone technology and usage, it's not even funny. Like years behind. And because of that, it's, you know, there's no reason for them to do this huge online game market because it's going to needlessly compete against something that already satisfies a need. So I don't think it's going to be as big a deal. And if anything, I actually really like the way the Xbox 360 achievement system is implemented because that's the perfect marriage of online and single player because there's an online aspect is that you're getting these achievements and you can share this information with other people and you can only really, I think you have to be, I've never not been on Xbox Live so for the 360, so I'm not sure. I don't think you can get achievements if you're not on Xbox Live. Yeah, I'm 99% sure that's correct. So you have to be on Xbox Live to unlock these things. And as long as you're signed in, you know, you never have to talk to a single soul for as long as you live. You can sign up for silver. You don't have to pay for it, but still you get these online achievements and then you can see how well you're doing. And that's like a great system. And even like the way Spore is working is that Spore is, you know, they're calling it the massively multiplayer or massively single player online role playing game. So it's instead of MMORPG, it would be MSORPG. And that's what I really like to see is that, and you know, there's an online experience, but it's done through, you know, just yourself. You don't need to experience it through other people, and it's done passively. So maybe they'll do something like that. But, you know, online, there's always going to be some aspect of online for these systems, but it's going to change. You know, right now, there's only so many different ways you can really have people get matched up and play multiplayer games online. You know, that's almost developed itself to the point of you're not going to see a huge amount of evolution in that area of gaming. But other aspects of achievement systems, things that Spore's doing, so on, that's still all brand new, really hasn't been touched, and you're going to start seeing a lot more in those areas. So thanks for your email. Next, I have Steve. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the ESA voluntary? If the FPA is passed, couldn't a publisher just remove itself from the ESA and have games that are not rated? Since it's not ratings pending, the game shouldn't fall under the act. What are the odds a publisher is making this move instead of dying off? Lee. So Lee's talking about the Family Protection Act that was implemented or actually brought up by Hillary Clinton in Congress, which is going to make games federally regulated. And he's saying that if a game doesn't go through the ESA and doesn't get rated, can't they just get around this act? And yeah, in theory, you're actually right. But There's zero reason that anyone would do that. I'll give you a perfect example is movies. The movie industry, you know, the rating system, you know, PG, R, etc., that's voluntary too, okay? You do not have to release a movie that has ratings associated with it in any way, shape, or form. But movie theater chains, like 98% of them, won't accept the movie unless it has a rating associated with it. They just won't. And guess what? It's the same thing. Stores nowadays have been trained so much with the ESRB ratings, they will not take games that aren't rated for the ESRB. Unless, you know, there may be, if there's some, like, if they're super old, there may be something weird, like maybe, I don't know, I'm just throwing something out. If it was some new type of game, like a handheld game, like a Nintendo Football or a Mattel Football type game, Nintendo Football, you know, like some weird system. But if you're going to release a PlayStation 2 game, it's going to have an ESRB rating. And if it doesn't have an ESRB rating, they're not going to stock it because they don't know what the heck can be on that thing and they don't want to be held responsible. They don't get bad press. You know, this is out there to protect them. So you're absolutely right. The same way movies, it does not have to be rated by the Movie Association, Motion Picture Association of America, the ESA, they do not have to have games rated. Now, I'm going to tell you something really, really interesting that you can now impress all your friends with. If you go to them and tell them, this is crazy, the same is not held true for stores like Best Buy. So, okay, movies will not be released in the large chains like Regal Cinema and so on unless they have an MPAA rating associated with them. But stores like Best Buy, they don't care. They'll release anything on DVD. You know, as long as it's not X-rated or, you know, pornography, they'll release unrated versions. And do you know why? The unrated versions of movies outsell the rated versions 9-1. So there you go. You can impress all your friends. But think about it. I often will go, if I buy it, I'll buy the unrated version, or at least want to take a look at it to see, ooh, what's new. And that's why you continuously are seeing these uncut, unrated versions that are being released. And the weird thing is, some of these could probably be X-rated. I mean, you know, if you think about it, if you have something like a Wedding Crashers, which is rated R, or like the 30-year-old version, two really funny movies. The 30-year-old version, I mean, that movie must have been so close to rated X, I couldn't believe it, or NC-17, because, man, that movie was so freaking dirty. It made the Wedding Crashers look like a Disney movie. I can't believe how dirty the 40-year-old version. And by the way, funniest movie I've ever seen. Oh my God, is that movie funny? But the unrated version, that must have been NC-17 or rated X easily, because that was so crazy. But, you know, Best Buy, no problem. They'll carry it. No problem whatsoever. But an AO game? No way. That's drawing the line. So again, take it for what you will, but thanks for your email. Next, we have Chris Kahn, who wrote, how do you think Nintendo is going to execute its existing franchises on the Revolution with its unique controller and online play? Wow, I have no idea. Okay, there's my answer. No, I actually don't know. What they're going to probably do it is, if I'm going to take an educated guess, they're going to be very safe with their main franchises. They're not going to use the controller, unless the controller takes off like a massive amount. It's going to be standard traditional games with Mario. Okay, they will probably have, you know, the Mario game and their Zelda games and so on, using the regular controller, because that's what people who play those games are used to. But they will have sort of wackier games, maybe the party games like Mario Party, that will use the wireless controller, you can, you know, sense where you're moving it in the air, or they'll come out with, I don't know, Zelda fishing game, or, you know, I'm thinking Metroid Pinball, which I love, by the way, for the DS. You know, that he has is like a rumble feature. That's some wackiness in the game. You know, maybe they'll come out with like a pinball game, you know, something like that. And that's how they'll use an experiment to see how it plays out. But their real franchises, you of course will be able to use it. Like if you want to use the controller, and there was actually a demonstration online of showing like traditional games using the unique controller, like in the air and like waving them around like a sword and like using it to steer Zelda throughout the world. Yeah, you can use it, but you don't have to. As for the online games, look at what they're doing with the DS and take it from there. You know, they're going to play it safe, but they're going to use it as smart and as intelligently as possible. You know, I know a lot of people are worried that, oh, you know, I've been reading some people are saying, oh, because of that, you can have all these, you know, having this controller that's so easy to use, you can have a lot of crappy games coming out for the Revolution. You can have a lot of games that are just like, you know, stupid fishing games that are made in 5 minutes. You know what? I don't think you will, because Nintendo is going to, they control whether or not games get released, and if they don't get approved, they're not going to come out. And they are going to try to make sure that, you know, good examples for the DS, they didn't release the wireless capabilities on crappy games. They released the wireless capabilities on their best games. And they really, you know, they made sure that the best games had the best capabilities, and that was showcasing these capabilities. So, you know, touchpad, yeah, there was a lot of touchpad games, but Nintendogs, that came out, and Electroplankin, which was a monster hit, of course, Japan, it's now coming out in the U.S. You know, those use just a touch screen and the speech capabilities beautifully. And now you, if you buy Nintendogs, any game that has those capabilities, you're going to be interested in. If they came out with games that were total crap at first by Nintendo that use those capabilities, you would never look at them again. You know, it doesn't matter if the third or fourth game that came out that used those capabilities were A-plus games. Doesn't matter. You would most likely write them off because you had a bad experience. But you use Nintendogs, or you use or the Electroplankton, or you're using Animal World. I'm like, I can't remember anything. Or the Mario Kart DS. You use any of those games, all fantastic experiences using the proprietary DS technology, wireless touchscreen, and now you're interested. You're hooked. You want to find more games that use these capabilities. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to be very careful. They're going to guard this and make sure that the games that come out with these things really use those capabilities well. Other than that, they're going to probably let the third-party developers fool around with them at first. So thanks for your question. Next up, I have, oh boy, a long one. Hey, Steve, my name is Lawrence Bell, that's how to pronounce it, Lawrence Bell for convenience, and I'm 24 years old, so I came looking around the corner when the post-game crash consoles appeared. I had the luck to experience the rise and fall of Sega, having the Mega Drive with all of its games. Sonic, of course. When Sega was announced back in the day, I was quite excited about it. Yet in the end, I purchased a Sony PlayStation and been hooked on Sony ever since. Yet Sega kept struggling. The Dreamcast was released, totally flopped. In the end, the first party Sega I knew. Luckily, Sega survived creating third party software. What were the major factors in this fall of Sega, and could Sega have done to counter it? Wow. So, that's a hell of a question. Sega, huh? Wow, that's really going back in time. Okay, well, let's tackle this one. So first of all, the problem with Sega is multifold. You have to remember, I mean, it's like, I really can't explain this to you guys enough. Japan and America, the markets, you think it's like, oh, it's a little different. No, it is so different, the Japanese and American markets. It is night and day, okay? It is, I mean, it could be another country. It is another country. And they have such an embedded language and culture, and just their tastes are so different. There's just so many things different in Japan and America that that's a large part of it. And one of the things is they're really loyal over there to brands. And they really were loyal to Sony, okay? And Sony had the PlayStation 1 come out, and that was such a monstrous hit. And then the Sega Saturn failed so badly. Even though Sega came out with the Dreamcast, didn't matter, because Sony said, we're going to announce the PlayStation 2. And you know what? Everyone in Japan waited. Okay, they, we'll wait. We're going to wait a year. We'll wait. We are not going to buy the new system because we love Sony so much that we will wait until the new system comes out. The only thing I can think of in my life that's even similar in America is maybe like the Apple iPod. I mean, you know, it's like people are waiting for the video iPod, at least people I know. And, you know, all these other handhold, you know, people who wanted video, the PSP came out. Nope, not going to get the PSP. Going to wait for the iPod to come out, even though it's never even been announced. And it's all rumor and speculation. These other things, these like iRivers and all these other handhold devices came out. Nope, going to wait. And sure enough, they had to wait a year or two, and voila, the iPod video came out, and boom, they bought it right away. You know, they just waited because they know how much they love their product. That's the only thing I can think of that's even close, and that's how they felt in Japan. You know, they really, really had to You know, they really were really going to wait for the PS2 and not going to buy the Dreamcast, GameCube, whatever the heck am I saying? Oh, okay, Dreamcast. So that's the first reason. The other reason is Square did not support it. Oh, yeah, and EA did not support it. There was no Square game and there are no EA games. Think about that for a second. No games for EA really came out for this thing? Nope. All the games were the 2K. That's where the 2K series came from, because there was no Madden. Like, there was no sports games. They had the 2K series, which actually ended up being a good thing in the long run, because those were great games. But Square, if Square is the same thing as EA not supporting it in Japan. If Square doesn't support your system, you're dead, pretty much. EA, so that those are two monstrous companies. And if those companies aren't coming out with games, there's not that many games coming out, and you're in a lot of trouble. The controller itself, I know people were a little angry that I said the controller stunk. A couple weeks ago, I was answering a question. Trust me, I loved the Dreamcast. I bought like four of them. I bought one for myself, one for my office, and I gave two as gifts. And I love that thing. And some of my favorite games of all time, but that controller stunk, okay? I don't care. People say, oh, I love that controller. That's fine. Okay, you guys can love the controller. That's your opinion. My opinion is the controller stunk for my particular hands, okay, and body. I did not like it. And finally, they had $100 million to market the system. Let me tell you, $100 million, it's nothing, all right? Sounds like a lot of money to market a system. You need like, oh, I don't know, a billion. I mean, you need a lot of money to market a system, a game system. It requires so much manpower, and it's a worldwide launch. I mean, they just didn't have enough to come out. And also, even the processor speed, you know, within the first year of the Dreamcast, you already started to see it hitting its limits, and it was, you know, it just wasn't enough. I mean, their whole strategy was they'll be first to market, they're going to be, you know, the first ones there, they'll get a foothold, they'll have people are interested in it, and then because they have people interested in it, developers will be interested in it, Sony's going to have to, you know, catch up, play catch up, and then they'll have, you know, a big advantage. Sound like anything, anyone we know? Sound like Xbox? A little bit. It didn't work out. It didn't work out at all. And what happens is, you know, Sony came out, PlayStation 2 did fantastic. Graphics were better. Controller was better. The game lineup was better. And people were loyal. And it was backwards compatible, which was a huge advantage. So that's sort of why they died. It's really sad. I mean, actually, of old game consoles, the Dreamcast had by far the most original, crazy games. You have Samba, I forgot, the Maraca game. I forgot, the Samba de la Hoya, is that how it was pronounced? You have Seaman, you have Soul Calibur, my favorite fighting game of all time that I probably put 2,000 to 3,000 hours into. I played that like a couple of hours every day for 2 years. I mean, this really had so many great games on that system. But, oh, Resident Evil, Veronica, oh, that was such a good game. Just so many great games. But it died. Oh, well, next one. All right, I got to get through these a little faster. I've been listening to your podcast for quite a while. Of course, I'm enjoying it since day one. I must say that I seldom come across a topic I disagree with wholeheartedly. However, your comment at the end of episode 31 was not only a bit overzealous, but false. If memory serves me, the original Perfect Dark did not contain the ability to either jump either. In a recent interview on Major Nelson's broadcast with the MSG producer of Perfect Dark, he said the director personally hated first-person shooters with no jumping. They implemented the combat role to substitute for a dodge or jump. I realize it's your opinion, but it's to go as far as saying the ability to jump is one of the many signs that the game was rushed is a bit bogus, I think. Keep up the good work, Nathan from Nashville, Tennessee. Okay, I actually got a couple of emails on this one, so I'm definitely going to comment on this. Is I said last podcast, one of the things I didn't like about Perfect Dark Zero is that you couldn't jump, and it was a sign that the game was rushed. And I am 100% standing by this, and I will back this up. Okay, a few things. First of all, let's go through whether or not the game was rushed. Let's see. Okay, first of all, the game period was rushed, all right? Multiplayer maps, a lot of them were taken out. I remember originally, I think it was supposed to be 48 maps and a ship with like 30 or 32. I'm not exactly sure of the solid numbers. I'm just doing this from memory. But they did drop out a couple of the multiplayer maps. Or I think it was supposed to be 64. Whatever. They dropped it out. They scaled it. I think it was 64, went down to 48. But they dropped out the multiplayer maps. That's one thing. But that's not the big one. The second reason is I played the game, and I played a game that was pretty much a recent build, and this was 4 weeks before the game shipped, and this game was buggy. And I don't mean buggy, I mean as in unplayably buggy, okay? And I know for a fact that this game was not in good shape, alright? And I have played a lot of these games. I've seen them right before they ship. Yeah, sometimes they're buggy, but I have games in alpha right now that I have in front of me that are in better shape than the Perfect Dark was when I played it. And I was actually stunned. I give these guys credit. They really did a good job at killing these bugs. And that's the second reason. Third reason is the game, it didn't go through Microsoft testing when it went gold. Now, what that means is that before any game, and I've never heard of this before in my entire life, before a game gets released on a console, what it does is it goes through stress testing, and it has to be approved. Basically, what they do is they take the game, they run it through tests, they actually have people who play it all the way through, make sure everything works perfectly, there's no bugs, everything says and does exactly what it's supposed to do, and then they'll approve it. And that could take like 2 weeks, sometimes even a month, depending upon the length of a game. And after a game has gone through that process, it gets the stamp of approval, then the publisher will then make the game gold and then ship it. So they didn't have time, okay? They had to rush this game so fast that they actually had to make the game gold, and they had to make millions of copies of this game, and then it went through testing. Now, obviously, it's Microsoft, so what's the big deal? If they lose, and be honest, it doesn't cost that much to press these games. I used to do it all the time. They're very cheap. So, big deal, okay? They can throw out these discs and redo it, but it takes time. If it didn't pass certification, they would have lost 2 weeks on this thing, at least, before it was been out. It would have been a huge PR debacle, but I have never heard of that in my entire life. I have never heard of a game that was made gold before it was certified, okay? That is crazy. I've never heard of it. So those are three perfect examples. The game was rushed, all right? As simple as that. Now, let's get back to my other statement, taking out the jump function. Now, I am going to 100% stand by the fact that if you take out the jump function, it makes balancing multiplayer a lot easier. Okay, period. It's simple as that. And the reason is because, and actually not even multiplayer, but the whole game, it's because you're taking out a whole level of access control. Okay, Condemned. There's no jumping in Condemned, all right? And you know what? I'm perfectly fine with it. I don't have an issue with jumping, all right? Guild Wars, not only can you not jump, you can't even walk down a gentle slope in some areas of that game. It takes me out a little bit, but you know what? I understand why they did it. You know, that's a design, that's something they did for the design of the game. And some games do take out jumping. Guild Wars took out jumping, from my opinion, just from what I know, for a couple of reasons. I meant there's some lag issues when they're, because you can play anywhere in the world. There's also people jumping all over the place. And I agree. In multiplayer games, I hate to see that. I hate to see people jumping all over the place, and it becomes like a whole jump fest, and you're seeing all these rabbits. And they might be right. They might have said, you know what? We don't want to have jumping in the game. We decided that it looks stupid. We're going to put in the combat role, and there's no jumping. Oh, and also the game was rushed, all right? So the two have nothing to do with one another. And that could be the case, okay? I could be completely wrong in the sense that there was, the jumping and the rush had nothing to do with one another. But I will stand by the fact that if you take out jumping, the game is so much easier to balance. Because all you have to worry about is just where you can walk on the map. You don't have to worry about all these crazy jumps. You don't have to worry about, jumping up and down and having these crazy things like, okay, if I jump up and then use my rocket blaster, I can actually get a little bit of impact, and then I can actually reach a secret area that I wasn't supposed to get into. I mean, that stuff happens all the time. You have all these factors they have to get into. It takes them so much longer to test these things. I was actually talking, just to let you know, my best friend, this guy is one of my best friends in the world. He was actually one of the best men at my wedding. He's the guy who designs all the dungeons in World of Warcraft. I told you I have friends. This is my best friend, and this is what he does. He's in charge of all the dungeons. Battlegrounds, okay, Warsong Gulch, he designed it. That's his, okay? Every dungeon you've played in that game, he's done it. Every single one. Those are all his dungeons, all right? This guy's probably, I would say, one of the authorities in the whole world on 3D level design. And by the way, this is all this guy does. That's it. He does 3D level design. That's it. He does nothing else. That's all he's done for 10 years. This is it. 3D level design. That's all he does in a full-time job. And I've talked to him a bit, and I was asking about this, and he's like, oh, absolutely. It takes forever. You know, designing Warsong Gulch or designing these maps, you know, only takes him a couple of months, but or a month or so. But then afterwards, testing them and balancing takes months. It takes much longer to actually balance it. And it's all those things like, oh, this area, if there's like two more steps on, like if there's two sides and one side has two more steps closer to the flag than the other, I guarantee it's like people will always find that. It's like people are amazing. It's like they run their tests, they'll see that people, if there's three paths to the flag and one path is two steps shorter than the other two, people will find that other, they will find it, and they just intuitively know that that way is a little bit shorter. And then you have things like jumps. If people find this little shortcut that you didn't, you know, if you didn't test on the map, and where on one side that you can jump up and sort of do this, like, jump and sort of this jimmy, and then shoot off your rocket launcher right at the, you know, perfect time, and then get up to this platform, and then quickly get the flag and break that level, they will find it. It's like they will always find that stuff. And if you didn't have jump, it's like, oh, this, I designed the level would be done. Simple as that. I mean, it's like, it take a day to test those things. It's really not hard at all. Because all the pathfinding, you can run algorithms to figure out what the, you know, how fast, how far flags are from each other, how far the middle of the board is from different, you know, waypoints, things like that. It's very easy to do. But once you put in jumping, once you put in that third dimensions, all bets are off. It becomes a much more difficult thing to design. So that's really what I was getting at. It's just that it is a time saver. It makes it a lot easier to design levels. And this is not just this game, it's all games, okay? And but I will put that, yeah, I will stand by that this game, Perfect Dark, was rushed, okay? And the two might, again, might have nothing to do with one another. They're just taking out that jump ability. So, anyhow, that was a very long answer, Nathan. And hopefully I got my point across. I think I did. Let me get to the next one. Hey, Steve, regards to your comments on NPR game sales figures, PC Gamer in their newest podcast said the decline in game sales is no real indication of the state of retail sales due to a significant amount of sales that are now to take place via direct downloads, such as Steam and EA download, and via MMO content, also via download. They say the decline in NPR sale figures is a direct result of online purchasing and download sales. There's no reason for concern. The game market, they say, is actually very healthy and indeed expanding. Obviously, this pertains mostly to PC games and not consoles. Could you perhaps give your opinion on this in your next show? Thanks. Happy holidays, Francis. So, yeah, the PC Gamer, they're talking about their sales figures, that sales were down, was it 16 or 18%? I think it was 18% in November overall from last year, and that was cause for concern because that's a huge number. Okay, that's a big drop in game sales. You know, like 2, 4, 6%, that's bad, but 18%. But overall for 2005, I believe overall game sales grew 6% from 2004 to 2005. It was just October and November, and from what I hear, December really were not that great in terms of game sales. And then if even the games that were big hits, they were all games from last year. Or sequels, like the best-selling game was Madden, and then like the second one was like Grand Theft Auto. I mean, these are all like, you know, the top games, like Pokemon, things like that. I don't have the list right in front of me, but no games in there were new releases from 2005. You know, there was no like Resident Evil in there. There was no God of War, you know, things like that. They were just older games. But I think the guys at PC Gamer are wrong. I mean, an 18% drop is huge, okay? And there's no way that that's being made up on direct download. Okay, first of all, PC games are such a small percentage of the overall market, and this is talking about the United States sales, but PC games are very tiny. Unfortunately, they really are, it's not disappearing, but when you compare it to console sales, I mean, console sales are continuously growing, getting bigger and bigger every year, and PC sales are really, they're kind of holding their own, but they're not expanding. And a lot of the sales are MMO related, like World of Warcraft. Like if you took out World of Warcraft, okay, and you took out other MMOs, PC sales would be pretty much destroyed. You wouldn't believe how small they were. But I do not agree with that. 18% is a huge drop, and there's no way that people are playing. I mean, that means like one out of almost every five people are, instead of going to the store, they're buying their games from Steam or EA Download. That ain't happening. But I will agree with the fact that, that PC gaming and gaming overall still is pretty healthy, and that's true. That is 100% true. It grew 6%. It's just that those months, which of course are Christmas months, and those affect everyone, because then not only, you know, it's like, okay, if the PC game sales, or not PC, if game sales are bad during Christmas months, not only does it affect the publishers, but it affects the retailers, it affects everyone. And if game sales are bad, then next Christmas, EA, Best Buy is gonna have a lot less space available for their video games because they didn't do as well. And when they figure out, what they do is they sit there, it's all math, and they figure out, okay, how much can we make per square foot? If DVD sales are making $100 per square foot per hour, and you know, video game sales are making $80 per square foot per hour, we're going to make the DVD sales area bigger and the game sales smaller. And that's all it is a numbers game. And that's why this is concerning, is because even if the overall sales market increases, if the critical Christmas season games don't do well, then they're just not going to give as much shelf space, and that will affect the overall market in the long run. So that's why this is concerning. And quite frankly, the amount of people who do direct downloads, at least in the U.S., is incredibly small, all right? It's not millions and millions and millions of people. We're talking about a huge amount of decrease. So I don't know. I don't know what those guys were thinking. But anyhow, it is still good that there is growth in the industry, and hopefully that will continue. And it is true that the MMOs, people are paying for those continuously, and those really aren't being factored in, you know, in the sense that, you know, maybe the sales are down, but everyone's playing World of Warcraft, which actually could be true. But you know what? That's not a good thing, because if everyone's playing World of Warcraft, then all these other companies go out of business, and then World of Warcraft takes over, and that's the only PC game out for a long time. So that's not a good thing either. We want to see game sales. You want to see a world where game sales are continuously growing and improving, and World of Warcraft is taking over the world. That's what you want to see. Okay, next. Oh my God, I have so many more. I got to go through these. Hey, Steve, how it's going? Not too long ago, I read that not too long ago, the Ridge Racer 6 was the worst-selling Xbox 360 title in the U.S., but the best-selling 360 game in Japan. It's interesting how different the two markets are. I hear about this sort of thing all the time. I'm sure this list is endless. I know I'm asking a mouthful. I was just curious, what are some of the things American developers and publishers have in mind when they're trying to release a game in Japan and vice versa? From the start of the project, it's already decided where you're going to release a game. Has your company ever ran into any speed bumps when trying to release a title in the Asian market? I'm curious how big the contrast is. And advance. Keep it the quality contest. Take care. Mario Gazzara. Oh, okay, Mario. Wow, okay, that was a lot of questions. Okay, let's get into that real quick. Yeah, I have actually released games in Japan, and I know how it works, and this is how it works. You find a publisher in Japan, and they will convert it. They'll do everything for you. They'll translate the game. They'll market it. They'll release it. They'll do all the conversion, the languages, and you do nothing. And they'd get a percentage of sales, and that's it. It is nothing to it. It actually is. It's scarily. It's actually simple, but not. It's really that simple. As for actually releasing a game in Japan and what you think for, okay, this is what you do. You release a game in Japan and you hope and pray it sells some copies, and that's the best you could do. American games in Japan, okay. I want you to sit down because you're not going to believe this. American games in Japan. Okay, if you took the top 100 games of all time in Japan, top 100 games, how many? I haven't seen this list in a couple of years, but I will tell you, how many games do you think that were developed in America? I'm not talking about the UK. I'm not talking about other kinds. I'm talking about American-based games, American-based publishers, developers who made the game, or you think were in the top 100 games of all time in Japan. How many do you think? Do you think it was 50? Do you think it was 20? Okay, I'm going to tell you, it was one. Okay, that's right. One game ever. Okay? Crash Bandicoot. The only game ever to crack in the top 100. And not only was it, it was a big game, too. Didn't just make crack top 100. It sold like a million copies, which is a lot in Japan. Okay? I've gone to seminars on this, on as to why. And these were packed seminars at GDC. It was like, how did they do it? How did they actually hit and make a successful game in Japan? And I could do 10 podcasts on this alone, this topic. But American games do terrible in Japan. Okay? And it's a very, very simple reason. Is American tastes are just completely different, okay? In Japan, the top games are role-playing games, simulation games, party games, gambling games, and fighters, okay? Fighters are, I mean, these are all games that are made in Japan to begin with. And what are the top games in the U.S.? First-person shooters, sports games, well, those are sort of it. those are the two biggest games. I mean, and games like kind of like an action games, like the Grand Theft Autos and the God of War type games. But look at all the top games. They're all EA Sports games, all right? Those are like some of the top selling this year. And the other ones, by the way, are all Japanese games, like Pokemon and stuff. But otherwise, they don't do. I mean, they don't care. They couldn't care less about American football. They couldn't care less about American basketball or hockey or really baseball, even though they love baseball. Trust me, they don't care. You know, some hardcores will buy the games, but they'll rather buy the Japanese baseball games. They're just not as big into it. You know, their tastes, I said this before, they're so different that American games flop over there. And on top of that, American games are so expensive in Japan, they're crazy. I mean, these games could easily be $80 to $100. And in Japan, this has actually changed in the last couple of years, but you couldn't return games. So it's like, if you bought a game and it sucked, then you're out of luck, okay? And you're not going to spend, and you're never going to buy an American game again. And on top of that, there's no used games, all right? I believe, and a couple years ago, you couldn't, it was illegal to sell games used and other things used. I think it was still done, like in back alleys, but you couldn't, there was no used market, okay? I know my brother-in-law and sister-in-law lived in Japan for several years, and they bought a used car. And the only people you can get used cars from were other Americans, and that was it. There was no one else. No one in Tokyo would get them. You couldn't find used cars from anyone else. But anyhow, it's just such a different culture over there. You can't. I mean, if you're going to make a game, you release it and you pray it does well. And you pray they do good localization. And that's the best you can do. Otherwise, you don't release in Japan. Or if you do, if it sells 10,000 copies, you thank God and congratulations. And that's why these deals, the way you do it is that you set it up with someone else and they'll take the risk. So you say, here's the game. You guys do all the work. We split the profits, you guys keep half, we keep the other half, and whatever you sell, good luck, and that's it, and then that's it, and you're done. So the only other company I can think of that really, really did a lot of homework and really looked very carefully at the foreign markets and did an amazing job, and you can kind of see it in the art style and see it in the gameplay, is World of Warcraft. And by the way, it's not huge in Japan, that's big in Asia, but that's one of the reasons, you know, the art style, a lot of people, you hear a lot of Americans, they don't like the art style of, you know, the World of Warcraft game. They think it looks a little cartoony and a little, you know, like a little too happy. Well, guess what? That's the type of art style that does extremely well in Asia. So, again, it's just the tastes are so different. And dark, moody games with first-person shooters, those do not do well, okay? Their dark games are the Resident Evils. Those do well. Doom, terrible. Terrible game. They hate that type of stuff over there. Again, I've gone to 100 lectures on this stuff and explaining why and what this is, why this is, but there's just, I can just keep going on and on. So, anyhow, thanks. Oh my God, this one is so long. I can't even read this one. All right, next one I have from Geo999. I actually wanted to ask you a question. What was your very first encounter with a video game ever? Wow, that's a great question, and I actually think this is my favorite question of all time from Geo. Okay, I have two. My very first encounter with a video game ever, well, it's like I have a couple. You see, I have memories of going to people's houses that had, like, Pong and stuff in the 70s, so I don't know if those, I don't know the order, but the two that I remember the most is of seeing video games, not, like, pinball machines, things like that, which I don't really consider. First is I was actually at a Sears in Hicksville, Long Island, and in the Sears I saw a Atari 2600. It wasn't even Atari 2600. It was like the Sears Master System because it was branded by Sears and sold by them, and on the screen was Combat. And I was like, oh my God, and it was like Christmas. I think it was like 77, and I couldn't believe that thing. I thought it was amazing. I wanted that so bad. I was like, oh, it was just stunning to see that game. I still to this day remember it. But of the other one that was just as big a deal was I was at Nathan's in Roosevelt Field, Long Island. There's a huge Nathan's there, and at these it's sort of a restaurant, and they also have an arcade in there. And there was a Space Invaders machine. And again, I guess this was like 77 or so. I forgot, 79, I think Space Invaders came out. 78, 79, I don't exactly remember the date. And there was Space Invaders. And I was like, it was just, you know, it was just like, what is this? Oh, my God. It was just such an amazing, you know, experience to see this machine. And the sounds were so wonderful. And I was like, oh, my God. I couldn't believe it. It was great. I actually do remember other games like, you know, Death Race and some of these other type of games. And there was like, there was a Seawolf game. And there was this game where you were shooting a shark that came in like in 75. And actually, that was kind of a creepy game, I remember. But those weren't really true. I mean, those were arcade games. But I remember them, but they're not as big of a memory as the two big ones when I saw the Atari 2600, Sega Master System, Atari Master System, and then or Sears Master System. Sorry, I can't get my words straight. And Space Invaders cabinet. Those were my two biggest memories, and from then on, I was hooked. But thanks for that email, because those are good memories. And three more. Hey, Steve, I wanted to know why you bash EverQuest so much. I really enjoy playing EverQuest and EverQuest 2. They're really good games, and I think they're more complex than WoW. I've played EverQuest since the beginning and keep improving with really challenging quests. Have you ever played EverQuest for any length of time? Got a good level character. I just don't like when people bash games. They really don't get into them well. Thank you for a great podcast, Brad Kahn. I played EverQuest. I played it since the beta. All my friends are playing WoW now, actually. They're all playing EverQuest. We played the beta. I think it was a monk. I had a character who got up to the 40s. I have vivid memories of playing EverQuest. I have vivid memories of being on the damn chessboard and sitting around for hours and hours and hours waiting for those damn pieces and camping them for them to appear and then kill them. You know, the big thing about EverQuest and why I bash it so much, I don't try to bash it, but the thing is that I had a real bad experience with Sony Online Entertainment. I used to love EverQuest, don't get me wrong. When EverQuest came out, I knew that that was like the beginning of the end, in a good way. It said like, okay, now average people are going to see the power of these video games, and you're going to now see all these things that are here, you know, happening, like people getting divorced and, you know, totally dropping out of society. Because at my school, I went to Carnegie Mellon, and at Carnegie Mellon, you had people that were getting into, you know, those text-based MMOs, the MUDs, if you will, and they were dropping out of school left and right. I mean, people just could not stop playing MUDs. Imagine EverQuest, but with text only. And they would spend all their time playing these things, and they would fail out of school. I had a good friend of mine. She failed out of Harvard. You can't really fail out. She kept getting put on leave of absence, but she could not stop playing. And I kept thinking, oh my God, if this stuff ever gets loose into the wild and your average person starts playing these games, forget it. And sure enough, when EverQuest came out, I was like, oh my God, here we go. Now the average person's going to see what these things are like and forget it. Video games going to be everywhere. And sure enough, it's happening. I used to love EverQuest. My big issue was just like the game design. I mean, when I look at games, I look at them very differently. Like my wife, as I said before, she's in the magazine industry. She looks at magazines. She looks at the ads, you know, the stuff I pull out and throw out right away. She looks at it. She wants to see how it's done, how it's printed. Same way, I always look at the games. I might like a game that most people might hate because I really love the game design, or I love certain aspects of the game that seem completely esoteric to other people. EverQuest, I really liked the game. I thought it was brilliantly made at first, and it was just so much fun, and having the whole multiplayer aspect, and then at the time the graphics were amazing, and the simultaneous play, it was just so much fun. But at the same time, you know, they really didn't design the game that great, and you know, a lot of things were implemented. They're like, oh, we'll have time to do it later. They didn't expect it to do as well as it did. And I've been to a lot of talks at Game Developers Conference. I remember one, my favorite talk of all time, I think it was Raff Costner, the guy who designed EverQuest, one of the main designers. Actually, sorry, not EverQuest, he was on Ultima Online, but it was on one of his talks, and him and a few other guys were talking about EverQuest and saying when it was designed that they expected people to get to level 50 in maybe 2 years. So the day it was released, they figured 1999, maybe by 2001, we'll have some people that get up to level 50, because it's going to take so long. And really, you know, they designed it so it's so hard after, like, level 40, 45, it was, like, impossible to get past, you know, those levels, because you had to really group. And they put all this stuff in there on purpose, because they just didn't finish the game, you know? And a lot of these guys, I mean, even World of Warcraft's guilty of this. It's like, you know, the game just wasn't finished, so... You know, the crafting system totally wasn't working, all these things. So they figure they have tons of time. They have next 2 years to flush it all out. 2 months later, the first person hit level 50, and they panicked, and they said, oh my God, we are dead. And they went to look, and this guy was playing 24 hours a day, and they couldn't believe it. They're like, how are these people playing all this? How is this humanly possible? These people are never stopping. I know a guy who, what he used to do is he used to actually sleep at his computer with his headphones on, really on loud, and he would camp out in front of these creatures that might appear, like, you know, every couple of hours to kill it. He used to fall asleep, and then when it started to hit him, the volume was up so loud that it would wake him up, he would kill the creature, and then go back to sleep, okay? That's how crazy people were. So... that's, you know, that's one of my, I know a lot, trust me, I play this game, but my big issue was that after I played the game, and I just saw, you know, there was a lot of things that was broken with the game, it took me 2 years to get my money back, to cancel the game, okay? It was so hard to get through. You kept calling Sony Online, Sony Online Entertainment, couldn't get through, but, you know, lines were busy, called every day, called all these times, they sent emails, nothing. It's going on for months and months and months. It was going on, I should have actually said something to the guys when I went to these conferences, I don't know what I was thinking, but it just went on for 2 years. I kept calling. Finally, I managed to get through in like 2001. I was like, oh my God, I want to cancel my account. I managed to get through. Luckily, the guy was nice enough. I said, look, I've been trying to get through for 2 years. Look at my account. It hasn't been played in 2 years. Can I get all my money back from all that time? And sure enough, the guy did. I managed to get all my money back. But, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, their customer service was terrible. And that's actually why they hate auctioning, because almost all their time is spent on these calls, is having people fighting over something that they got on eBay. And they were spending like 70 to 80% of all their calls have to do with, for Sony Online, is to deal with people getting ripped off by other people on these online auctions. And they was taking too long. It was just taking up so much of their time. So I figured, why not beat them, join them? And I've talked about that before in my show way back when. Anyhow, yeah, I do, you know, EverQuest, and quite frankly, EverQuest 2, you know, they did everything in their power to just try to kill World of Warcraft, you know, and they really, really did a lot. You know, they designed it in such a way that they did a lot of pretty cool things. I do have to say, the graphics in EverQuest 2 really are beautiful. And, you know, I do like kind of the way it shows you, like, the traveling back to your body and things like that. But, you know, as I say, if you see World of Warcraft, you know, they put a lot of things in EverQuest because it made sense. Like, if you die, you should be penalized. You know, that's the way these games work. You should have to go get your body because that's the way these games work. You know, things that just happen. Well, then, you know, well, why do you have to? Okay, that's not fun. Okay, going on corpse runs was a nightmare. I hated it. I had a friend, I remember he was level 14. He died so much, he went down to level 12. He had so many experience points penalized. That's not fun, all right? That's not a fun experience. So why do you put it in? Oh, you have to penalize them. Well, it's not fun, and I'm not going to play. So that's, you know, there's other reasons to design a game, is that not because it should be, but you can cheat and you can come up with new ways, like World of Warcraft. They did a great job, you know, that system where of going, you know, going back to your body as a ghost, and there's this tiny price to pay, you know, a little bit of gold for wear and tear on your items and some time. That's enough. That's enough to prevent me from dying and not wanting to do it. And if I do die, so be it, but it's not too bad. Anyhow, thanks for your question, and next I have a question for you. I'd like your opinion on. Everyone says Nintendo is down for the count. Nintendo should just sell to Microsoft, get out of the business altogether with the Revolution getting ready to come out. Price well below the PS3 and Xbox 360. You think that will really be revolutionary? You think it will sell well and really do as well as the GameCube is now at 99 and not doing that well until Zelda comes out? Nintendo does make great hardware, I know, and they're all about the games. What do you see the future of Nintendo as a big Nintendo fan? And be sure to get Revolution. All right. And this is actually also from Brad, same guy. So Nintendo, I wouldn't worry about Nintendo too much. Again, Nintendo bashing is so, it's almost like, oh, people love to bash Nintendo all the time, yet they're laughing all the way to the bank, okay? Their net worth this last 10 months, they've increased their net worth of the company by 15%. EA went down. A lot of other game companies went down. Nintendo's, they're doing great. Last week, the Nintendo DS sold 598,000 units in Japan, okay? That's just in 1 week. It sold 600,000 units of the DS in Japan, and that's in 1 week. They sold 302,000 units of Mario Kart DS, all right? I'm looking at the top 10 games in Japan. Five of them are from Nintendo, okay? They're not, there's no Xbox games. Oh, yeah, by the way, Xbox sold 105 copies, okay? Think about that for a second. The Xbox One game system in the entire company of Japan sold 105 copies. All right? DS, 598,000. Now, this is a worldwide market, all right? You know, it's like Nintendo, the Revolution, the GameCube, it actually sold just a little bit less than the Xbox worldwide. And people are like, oh, you know, they're in third place. Well, they never factor in the Game Boy or the Game Boy DS or any of these other systems. When you factor in the DS, and trust me, that's a lot of systems, okay? The original Game Boy sold over 100 million copies. It's still one of the best, I think it's the best-selling console of all time in the whole entire world, okay? And they made money on every single one of those. You know who's in third place by a distant third? Is Xbox, not Nintendo, all right? You know, you can make these charts do anything you want. You know, people were touting, oh, Nintendo, their profits dropped 51% in one quarter. Well, you know what? That doesn't mean anything. It's revenues that you really should be looking at, okay? Profit means, okay, they could have made $4 million one quarter, now they made $2 million, all right? But if the revenues go up, that means they're making more money, all right? They're just not keeping more of it, and there could be a million reasons for that. They could be paying down debt, they could be buying companies, they can paying off promissory notes, who knows what they're doing with that money. But I really am not too worried about Nintendo. They have a monstrously loyal following in Japan. They do very well over there. And on top of that, one thing that they do that no one else really does is they own everything. So I'm looking at the top games. Mario Kart DS in Japan, Pokemon, Mario Party, DS Training for Adults, Work Your Brain. These are all owned, well, except for Mario Party. Sorry, that's Namco, but they get the licensing. Those are all owned by Nintendo. So what does that mean? That means they get every penny of the profits. You know, if someone else sells a DS game, like, you know, like Shrek 2 sells or whatever, Game Boy game, well, they get a license fee. Nintendo gets a license fee for every Game Boy game and DS game that gets sold. But for the DS and for Nintendo game, if Nintendo Dog sells or Mario Kart DS, they get every penny because that's their game. They develop it. And all the top titles are their games. So they make so much more. So even if their games don't sell quite as much, they make so much more on those games and makes up for it. So I wouldn't worry too much. I know everyone wants to write off Nintendo, but, and the, you know, oh, Xbox is huge, Microsoft's so big, Nintendo should give up. Xbox, yeah. Nintendo, they're doing fine. They're growing, they're making money. They are increasing share, especially in Japan. They're doing just as well as Xbox in the United States. Worldwide, they're destroying the Xbox. I wouldn't worry about them. Another one. Steve, is there any way you can help me get an internship for the summer testing games or working for a gaming company? Be very grateful if you help me out, because one with all the information context, you really need to get an internship testing position. And this is from Alex. Alex, real simple. Contact the companies directly. I mean, I know it sounds crazy. Yeah, that's what I used to do, and that's how I got internships and jobs. They hire them. They have whole programs set up. EA will hire interns. I know Big Huge Game has a whole bunch of interns. You write them and say, I want to be an intern. How do I do it? And they'll go through everything and tell you how to do it. That's really your best way. Knowing people doesn't hurt, but trust me, these companies need interns. They're going to be looking for them. So don't be afraid just to do it that way. And Let's see. Finally, I have great podcast, but I was upset about your top games of 2005. You did not include Mario Kart or Animal Crossing, Wild World, which were my favorites. Please tell me why they were not on your list. The 10 dogs. By the way, I think I called Animal Crossing Animal World or something. I don't know. I'm getting a little crazy in this podcast. Yeah, I got a couple of emails. I'm sorry. I actually missed a couple. I did a lot of those games from memory. But, yeah, I missed. I should have included Mario Kart and Animal Crossing. Those are definitely games you should get. But I'll be honest, probably everyone has those. Two others that I forgot, just off the top of my head. Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney. That is such a fun game. And if you want to see what a Japanese game is like a real big Japanese game, buy that. And you're going to see it's so unique. I mean, it's almost like a story being told in video game form. And you're probably like, probably playing it going, wow, this is really strange. It's not really a game. It's really just kind of a story being told in video game. Well, those type of games are monstrously popular in Japan. That's definitely one you should pick up. And I think it's getting hard to find from what I've been hearing. It might have been discontinued or something. So go grab it now if you want to play it. And City of Villains. I forgot about City of Villains. The follow-up to City of Heroes. Fun game. I've been playing it a bit. I kind of still almost like City of Heroes a little bit. It's actually kind of nice because City of Heroes isn't as populated right now because people are going to play villains. I kind of like that. It's actually a little bit more fun with a little bit less people in the world, which is kind of strange, but I don't know. It just is working out that way. But those are two games off the top of my head that I totally forgot about. I probably forgot a few here and there. Hey, but if you have any, feel free. Those are just some of the... I was just trying to put together a list of games that you guys should consider buying or looking into. And I was thinking about it. And by the way, my top game of 2005, if I did, even though I didn't list it, I would say my top game of 2005 overall was Psychonauts. That's right. Psychonauts for the Xbox. That game, it's funny. I've been thinking about it. It's one of those games I had issues with it when I was playing it, but of all the games I played, it's the one that stuck with me the most. And I guarantee in 5-10 years, I'm going to look back at that game and love it. And I still love it, don't get me wrong. I mean, it has an incredible, incredible, beautiful level design, really fun leveling, fantastic writing, the best voiceovers I've heard in a game in years. And just it, and the game, and one thing I liked, the levels were getting better. It's one of the rare games where, you know, I can't think of like the original Mario 64 did that, where as you played the games, the levels were getting better and better and better and harder and deeper. Same thing with this game. The levels would get more and more crazy and wacky and interesting as you continue through the game. But if you did not buy this game, shame on you. Go out, buy Psychonauts, play it. You'll love it. It's a great game. Fantastic platformer. And oh my god, that's the show mail, and I don't think I'm ever going to answer that many again. Let's get the final thoughts.
Game and Steve's final thoughts.
See, now that's why I didn't do a game talk, because I think that was just an hour of show mail. That was nuts. That's too much. I'm going to answer everyone's questions, but you know what? I'm going to be a little bit more picky from now on, because I just can't keep doing an hour of show mail show. I know you guys really like it, but I can just do a show on show mail. This is getting a little nuts. So does anyone listen to these final thoughts? Because I put out things. It's funny, like I talked about the T-shirt design contest in final thoughts a few months ago. No one wrote to me. And then I talk about it in the beginning of the show. Everyone wrote to me. Like 20 people came out of the woodwork saying they wanted to do T-shirt designs for the site. So if anyone's listening to this, let me know. Let me know that you're listening to Final Thoughts, and maybe I'll give out a prize next week. Yeah, that's what actually I'll do. I'll give out a prize. So write to me. Tell me that you're listening to my Final Thoughts, and tell me what you thought your favorite game of 2005 was. There we go. So the little contest, the Final Thoughts contest. You write to me. You write to me. Contact GameSteve, whatever you want, and I will throw it together. You tell me what your favorite game of 2005 was. I'll put some together. Maybe I'll do some things with it, see what the most popular one was, and you tell me what it was, and I'll throw together a contest, and I'll pull someone's name and give you maybe the stamps, those French stamps, video game stamps, which are gorgeous and super cool. Otherwise, I got to go. It's getting late. I'm real tired, and my voice is going, and I'll talk to you guys later. Cheers to a good 2006. See ya.
listening to Gaming Steve. If you have a question or comment for Steve, please drop him a line at GamingSteve.com. You've been listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, remember to always end a well-rounded breakfast with Fatality!